Oppression? Right. Oppression, it's a session. One more lesson coming out the mouth. I got no doubt that I'm gonna be on the path. How we gonna do it? I don't know. I got no answers. Just a lot of fucking people. Yo, my spine is cancer. I got a lot of heart. I got a lot of soul. And if we step outside, I might even have to go smoke a whoa. I'm not gonna talk about that, cause like a fucking hot hat. My top hat got snatched by the Mad Hatter. And then we're gonna go fucking chit chatter. And all my folks get up and fucking put your rice on a platter and be proud as you eat your tamales. Don't forget about the frijoles and don't forget about the tortillas. Yo, my fucking Pancho Villas, where you at? My zapatos, por favor, take off your hat. Do whatever the hell you need to. Fucking step up, yo. Fighting oppression's been going on for 513 years, yo. Thank you. Boop. Yeah. I got a show every Monday night, 101.1. Yeah, check it out. Augusto Cesar Sandino Segundo. Paz.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, broadcasting here on Freak Radio, 101 FM. Tune in every day at noon for this daily national, international, unembedded grassroots news hour. But not just every day at noon, Monday through Friday. Tune in anytime, 24 hours a day, because Freak Radio is your radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with activist and attorney Brooke Meekins about low-lying island countries that face threats of climate-related disasters. We'll also speak with Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine about venture capitalists who are supporting emerging clean energy technologies. Brooke Meekins joins us in our studio today. She's the author of a blog called DrowningIslands.com and also an activist and attorney who specializes in providing legal assistance and advocacy for the populations of low-lying island countries who face threats of climate-related disasters. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So when I describe what you do, it's just, it makes a big impression because I don't know how many people there are in the world who specialize in legal issues for island nations that might be impacted by climate change. How did you fall into this career?
Well, I would say that the first thing I knew I wanted to do was to go to law school. I wanted to help people on an environmental level, but I thought that the best way for me to do it would be to get formal advocacy training. Mm-hmm. I'd always wanted to be a lawyer. And so when I was in law school, I started learning about climate change torts. So that's when one individual has the ability to sue another individual based on climate change related damages. That was so sexy and interesting to me, honestly. I just thought, okay, that is what I need to do. And so I started learning more about these locations that now I get to travel to and really started caring for the people. And as soon as I got out of law school, I became involved in litigation and realized that litigation is an awesome tool. It has great power to bring about justice. But it's also flawed in that it's not available to everybody. Sometimes it takes a great deal of time. It takes a great deal of money. And also it can really rile people up and it can get them more upset than they already are. So sometimes it's just the perfect tool to use and sometimes it's not. So now I see myself specializing in litigation and also non-litigation, more creative, interesting, sometimes helpful tools.
So let's get back to this issue of torts where an individual can sue another individual for climate-related damages. This is fascinating. Is it usually an individual suing an individual, or is it more like a group of people could theoretically go after ExxonMobil or some other big corporation?
Well, a group of people could theoretically go after a big corporation or some emitting body or entity. And, in fact, that has happened. There's a case called the Kivalina lawsuit, and it was filed when I was in law school, so years ago. I know the lead plaintiff's attorney on the case, Matt Pawa, and he's just an awesome advocate for climate change victims. The problem with climate change torts is that we don't have an example yet of it really working to mm-hmm. solve the sort of problem that we have with climate change. And so, yes, theoretically, a group of individuals or possibly even one individual could sue an emitter and, in fact, have done so. It just, we haven't seen it yet work.
How did you get involved with this issue of what you call drowning islands in particular?
Well, I was in Costa Rica at a best friend's wedding a couple of years ago, and I was just out swimming in the ocean. I love the water, and I always have. And I got stuck in a riptide and was out struggling in the water just by myself. I mean, there were people around me, a couple of people, but it was really an internal individual struggle. And it was scary, of course, and I ended up getting out and I was fine a couple of days later. But I really thought about that experience after the fact, and I thought about, I guess, the irony, for lack of a better word, because I had been interested in these low-lying island locations for a long time and just felt like their story wasn't being told, because, again, this was a couple of years back before we were talking about the Maldives and Tuvalu and Kiribati, mm-hmm. or Kiribati. And so in the months that followed, I really narrowed in on my goal and my commitment to helping these countries and really just to listening to them and to relationship building, mm-hmm. because I think that I identified with a water-related struggle and the feeling mm-hmm. of isolation.
Now, what does it mean for them when you talk about drowning islands and sea level rise? What does that really mean? How is it going to impact some of these nations if the sea level rises due to climate disruption?
Well, the countries of Kiribati, Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, and the Maldives are four of the most threatened countries, if not the most threatened countries, because what's unique about them is that each of those four locations stands less than 10 feet above the water level. Less than 10 feet. That's the highest point in all of those countries. And so there's threatened coastal communities all across the world, but these countries are unique in that they don't have high land that people can retreat to. And so as the water level rises, and also as we have exacerbated weather-related or climate-related disasters like cyclones and hurricanes and stormwater intrusion, then those countries are uniquely threatened because they have no high ground. So salinity changes, agriculture is negatively impacted, freshwater lenses are disappearing, people are losing drinking water. And then, of course, as storms and floods come, their homes are flooded, or some of them have hopefully not yet casualties, but health-related mm-hmm. issues mm-hmm. because of this. So it's really it's a varied problem, and it impacts them in all areas of life.
So for them, it's their entire way of life and even their nation that's at risk.
Yeah, exactly. That's what makes these four countries unique, because their very identity as not only a culture, but as a political system is mm-hmm. threatened.
Which of these islands have you visited, and what effects of climate change have you personally witnessed?
So of the four, I've been to the Maldives and to the Marshall Islands, both just fascinating, beautiful countries. And I'm actually visiting the other two here in the next couple of weeks. I'm really excited about that. I've also had the opportunity to visit some other places that maybe not the whole country is threatened, mm-hmm. but some other places that are threatened by coastal sea level rise as well. In terms of what I've personally witnessed, I think one of the most fascinating things every time when I go to one of these places is that they have trees and sea life that is just brown or dead. And so that's one of the things that I really love taking pictures of. The first opportunity I get when I go to one of these places is the palm trees that are failing, the pandanus leaves and trees that are failing, other vegetation and sea life that just is not surviving. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the quickest ways to tell that you're in an impacted area. But then also, one of my favorite things to do is to just walk around and meet with regular individuals on these countries or on these islands and just talk to them about the impacts that they've felt, because they're the ones that have seen it every single day.
If island populations end up being forced to relocate, what do you think are some of the difficulties that they're going to face?
I think the biggest difficulty is cultural cohesion. A lot of these islanders so far, including the politicians on these islands, are saying, we're not leaving. And so that can be a really difficult struggle to come up with a decision as a body of people together. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's one of the biggest problems we have so far, or one of the biggest issues. There was a great conference put on by the Columbia Law School and by the Marshall Islands. Mm-hmm. Last year, it was called Threatened Island Nations, and it was really interesting because academics from all over the world got up and talked about what these islands are going to face when they actually move. And at the end of the conference, it was a couple of days later, one of the representatives from the government of the Marshall Islands got up. He was very gracious, and he thanked everybody for all of their hard work and their research. But he said, I think that you have sort of missed the point. We're not moving. Mm-hmm. We're not relocating. And so we want you guys to go back and do the hard work of figuring out how we stay.
Right.
So that's one of the most intriguing and difficult parts right now, is figuring out how to come up with a cohesive plan for these people that are very divided in terms of what they want to do.
How do you end up connecting with these people?
And welcome to the somewhat late start for Bathrobe's Pier's Broadsides, which is your Sunday morning show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norris. We talk lots about the local struggle to end laws that criminalize poor people. And that's something that was actually happening on the streets for about 3 hours on Friday night. I'll be playing some audio from that and taking your phone calls, playing some earlier street interviews, and doing some more updates. We'll see how that goes. The call-in number here is 427-3772, 831-427-3772. And we are, of course, broadcasting. If you check your radio dial, in case you're listening to us locally, at 101.3 FM. 101.3 FM, Freak Radio, Santa Cruz, what you're listening to. You can also be listening to the stream, which is at, well, go to TuneIn on your browser, one word, tune in, and then click on the initials FRSC, or actually write them in if you don't see them, and you'll catch our stream. You can also go to our website for archived shows in case you want to make donations, in case you're interested in being a subscriber. It doesn't really, that sounds like KPFA. We're actually, we don't have subscribers. We have people who kick down a little money for T-shirts and things. We have people who donate equipment. We have people interested in becoming members themselves because they want to do some broadcasting. And there are open spots. All you have to do is essentially contribute to the rent that we pay for this modest little studio and to keep the transmitter going, and you can do it. Plus, of course, you have to pass the pass muster with our central committee. But in fact, that's not that hard to do. We are a left-wing station for sure. So some people call it more genteelly underrepresented peoples and oppressed peoples and that sort of thing. And that's true, too, for sure. But if you want to do white supremacy, this is not the station for you. You got to start your own station or perhaps go to the mainstream and, wrap it up in a pretty bow and call it the war on terrorism, perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, that's kind of a vague description of what's happening today. There are a couple of events happening today. I believe Micah Posner is running for Santa Cruz City Council. I think there are 8 or 9 candidates running this particular year. I don't think much of this the race or of the candidates in terms of at least their expressed positions. Even Steve Plaich, who's running for City Council and is a frequent contributor to the show, has me grumbling because when you start running for these sort of mainstream offices, you tend to go more mainstream. And, well, I guess there are some who believe in the idea of boring from within. I'm bored by all the boring from within, or rather just more frustrated and annoyed with it, and tend to be somewhat knee-jerk in my rejection, because I think, well, certainly half a loaf is better than no loaf, but there seems to be a lot of loafing and not much doing, and actually what's doing is all on the wrong side of the ledger there. We got sweeps against homeless, seizure of homeless property, laws that criminalize people in public spaces, increased appropriations for the police, or at least it seems increased police activity. There's an appropriation coming up on the city council agenda, for example, for $250,000 for security guards all around the town, as though there's some sort of menace. These are just designed to intimidate people. There's no crime wave that I'm aware of, though perhaps there should be, I don't know, given the distribution of the wealth and given the fact that people are doing a lot of things at twice the speed to essentially stay in the same place, much of which they don't enjoy doing. But, yeah, the security, there's a lot of focus on maintaining the status quo, or perhaps even going back to a more repressive status quo, which is even worse. You know, we have wars abroad, we have wars on the poor at home, and we have, well, not much opposition. I think there is opposition. I saw some of it on Friday night when folks came out to a rally to end the sleeping ban and to stand up for the rights of poor and homeless people. And as usual, you know, I've got criticisms of how that went down, and, you know, sure. And I think we can all learn from experiences as we go ahead, and I'm going to be talking about that as I play some of the audio for the Friday night tent vigil, tent monster vigil, not quite sure. It has a number of names. There used to be flyers everywhere, and I'm having trouble seeing one now. I think there are three on the door to the studio. Hats off to Brent Adams for the incredible publicity job he did. He is certainly a veritable Chris Doyen of publicity, and pretty much did most of the organizing of this event himself. So, let's jump into the show, but first let's hear a little musica to give me a chance to stretch my legs and empty my bladder and sip a little coffee here and get it together, and I will be back. Hopefully you, if you're listening, whoever you may be, will also consider joining the show with reports about what's happening in your neighborhood or city or country, if you're listening from out of the country. Sometimes people do. How are homeless people treated there? I hear Rhode Island has a homeless bill of rights. I hear India has made a court decision at the highest level that people have a right to sleep. Let's hear about what's going on. I hear that, you know, I actually was trying to find out about Rhode Island. Is Rhode Island, this is some sort of paper bill that has nothing to do with real behavior on the streets of authorities that have been repressing homeless people? Or is Rhode Island the Roger Williams home, the great historic dissenter from four centuries ago, finally coming into its own again, the smallest state with the biggest heart and all that sort of thing? I don't want to pass on any illusions. There are too many already, but I'm thinking about that stuff and hoping to do some more research on it, too. We also have a measure in California. I mentioned in the last show last week a finding that LAPD cannot run around doing what Santa Cruz police and Parks and Rec rangers and sheriff's deputies do, stealing homeless property by claiming it's unclaimed or abandoned. That's not kosher, unless it's obviously trash, and tents are not trash. Memo to the police departments. Tents or survival gear, then you can't destroy it. You have to hold it for 90 days. That's actually state law. So the kind of arrogance and obliviousness and just wretched derogation of homeless people to second and third class status that we've been living under and are still living under, I'm not aware that the Santa Cruz authorities have changed their policies, is very real. So, I'll be back, and hopefully you will too.
An injection of time straight to the vein from the long hand of the claw that's red with the life it's drained. An umbrella flew from the tip of my tongue to shield us from the truth of what we become, what we become. And now the moth fitting the cloak of the night sky creeps into my bed where you lie. No. From shadow. Oh, babe, how I wish you'd been able to carve the tablet to tell of my time at the farm. A childish scenario recited for crooks, wasted on idle minds just for pretty looks. Now the moth spinning the cloak of the night sky shadow. I'm just making shapes from shadow. I'm just making shapes from shadow. I'm just making shapes from shadow. Oh, oh. And now the moth-bitten cloak of the night sky creeps into my bed where you lie. Where you lie. Where you lie. Where you lie. No! Shadow.
And that was a cut. What do you call it? A cut. A bit from Rin Tin Tiger Toxic Pocketbook, Pretty Looks. So, well, let's begin with perhaps what regular listeners may be most interested in, which is the Friday event, though I suppose many of the regular listeners, or many of you regular listeners out there, actually went to the event. There were a lot of new faces, or let's not say a lot, there was a significant number of new faces, at least a third new faces, I'd say, and folks showed up at the original gathering at City Hall. Again, the purpose of the protest was to stand up to the kind of institutionalized bigotry and attacks on homeless people that are going on under the guise of fighting illegal campsites or crime or drug users or the menace of a possible physical attacks by homeless people, which there was one murder by one homeless person who came to town and, God help us, went to the homeless services center and got services and then stabbed to death the owner of Camouflage. And that became the cause celebre, and the pinup child, or the bloody pinup rag for a bunch of groups like Take Back Santa Cruz and Downtown Neighbors, Santa Cruz Neighbors, Downtown Association. They didn't use it explicitly, but it became the basis for the city council to, well, the police department to begin this 7-week-long campaign of destruction of homeless campsites, ticketing, and arrests, which is, as regular listeners know, documented on the Santa Cruz Police Department blog, which you can check. I'm not aware that they're going into an 8th week formally or a 9th week. It looks like they kind of stopped at the end of August, at least in terms of publicizing what they're doing. I'm not clear whether they've stopped doing it or they've just simply stopped bragging about doing it. So I have to kind of wait for more information on that. If you do have any information, I encourage you to call into the studio and talk about what's been happening to your friends, to people you know, what you've seen, what you've experienced. 427-3772. 427-FRSC is the number here at FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. So give a call, 427-3772. We can talk. Of course, if you have any thoughts about anything I've said, feel free to call in and comment if you'd like. I'll be doing some other updates. There's not a lot of updates happening. There are some. Santa Cruz 11 continue to, broil in the hot water, just sort of cooking away. We aren't facing a trial until January. I'll be talking about that. Then there's a case coming up that really long-time listeners may remember, the mock Nazi salute case, where two mayors and the estate of a third mayor are going to be sued in court in a long-delayed trial. It's been delayed 10 and a half years so far. 10 and a half years. in order to hold them accountable for false arrest at city council and to essentially expose the city council's repressive rules and practices around its critics who come to council using the guise of disruption. They disrupt their own meetings and then claim that other people are doing the disrupting and evict them or threaten them and shut them down, when in fact city council is supposed to be a public meeting where the public can present and petition the government for a redress of grievances. And of course it's not. It's a sort of a show thing, similar to a lot of the other corrupted institutions we have in this country and in this world. I don't want to say that the other countries have a lot of better institutions. We need to make fundamental changes everywhere, I think. Although, you know, I'm most familiar with the abuses here in the United States and Santa Cruz because I've been living here and looking at them and writing about them and experiencing them firsthand. So, let's hear some audio tape from the Friday activities. I actually began this tape on Pacific Avenue because I was heading over to City Hall where we were, all of us, meeting, and then marching around town with candles or wandering around town and stopping at various points to take back public spaces in a kind of symbolic way, and then to return, make some more speeches, and go home. Which always leaves me a little cynical, because in the past, such protests were usually included things like sleepouts and direct challenges to the ordinances and encouraging people to find a safe place to sleep. There are several people in jail. There are numerous people who went to jail for this. One of them is currently in jail, Gary Johnson. Another is under house arrest, Ed Fry, for, in essence, setting up a safe zone for homeless people 2 years ago. We seem to have gotten away from that, or people are afraid to do that, or they don't want to recreate that. We all know it's more necessary now than ever. I mean, there's not only is the homeless lack of services center not provide even the 46 spaces. Well, it was providing 46 spaces, not on an emergency walk-in basis, but you get on a waiting list, wait 2 to 6 weeks. If you don't displease the authorities there, like Andrea Morgan did, for instance, disabled activist, got kicked out, then got robbed outside. It's all on Santa Cruz Indie Media if you want to go read about it. Then you can get in. But now there is even less of that because, according to, I think, reports from the Homeless Lack of Services Center themselves, they are, you know, remodeling their stuff. And in remodeling it, they haven't made any provision for homeless people who they're going to be ousting, even those 46 homeless people that are waiting to get on that list. And we're talking about 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in the city limits and thousands more in the county. This is, they're token efforts that are happening, not to disparage the goodwill and the caring of people who are making those efforts, except insofar as in so doing, they decide to collude with authorities in criminalizing everybody else in order to keep their own small programs going. Then they certainly need to be criticized, and I do that a lot. You hear me criticizing Homeless Lack of Services Center Director Monica Martinez for all kinds of specific concerns, mainly having to do with the sleeping ban and how she is kind of colluding with authorities to get send activists to jail, actually, two of them, and also not to provide documentation for homeless people so they can avoid jail. You know, instead she presents a sort of a frilly, fluffy, smiley exterior anyway. I've talked about that too much. But here is the Friday, some series of audios from Friday. And my machine kind of died of batteries and tape problems about halfway through the rally, so I'm going to have to kind of give you my secondhand ex post facto kind of after the fact impressions. And I'll do that. And if anybody was on this march who's listening and has their own thoughts about it, please do call in 427-3772. Don't be shy. Don't necessarily wait until you think there's a long space, but call in when you feel that you have something you want to say, because I give primary focus on and place to those who call in. So let's give it a try.
I'm here on the corner at Westside New Leaf about 20 to 7 on Friday the 7th, talking with you.
Oh, my name is Cage.
And Cage, you're a man whose guitar says, "My world is insignificant and eternally infinite." So you're both being both grandiose and at the same time very modest, I think.
What's the point in being anything but modest? But,
or perhaps you're just being realistic.
As I'd like to think of it more like that.
So,
as far as it goes, the world is, my world in particular, as much as anybody else's, is fairly insignificant. And
a lot of people here on Art Friday, looks like you've been picking a little money. Anything to report? You were saying not much, but how long have you been in town now?
This time, 4 days.
And you have your No Hobo disc with you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And the name, are you in fact known by that moniker, or is that the name of the album?
That's the name of the duo. It's myself and a mandolin player. He's in British Columbia right now, saving up a little bit of money to come back down so we can open up a little small studio for ourselves.
Here in Santa Cruz?
Possibly here in Santa Cruz, definitely in the Bay Area somewhere. And yeah, this place has always treated us well. We like it here. And we've thought about doing things here. It's friendly people. I haven't had too many negative experiences in this place, you know, compared to many others. So I figure, as far as anywhere else goes, this is as good a place as any.
Have you been moving around with the art on Art Friday or whatever?
No, I've been pretty busy trying to save up the money to get myself indoors again.
You are outside illegally, as usual?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you're aware there is a homeless vigil tonight that starts at the City Hall and moves about the town. I see you're pulling a flyer out of your pocket.
At 7 p.m.
You intend to join this crowd of ragamuffins wandering the streets?
I will be in the streets, as per usual, but more than anything, I plan on telling as many people about this as I can, and hopefully they will go out and walk, and I will be out here singing and trying to promote that in my own way.
Do you have any songs of the street that you wish to pass on at this point?
None that I don't think you've already gotten.
Very well, then we'll just have to wait for another time. We've been talking with
Cage.
Thanks, Cage.
Thank you, Robert.
Appreciate your indulging. Yeah, we got a report. What you got?
All it is it's actually a positive one about.
Oh, that's good. First of all, we're talking with.
I'm Jack Kolb.
What you got, Jack?
I have Officer Winston saw me sitting down trimming my mustache.
Next to a building, perhaps?
Yes, I
was. That's a crime in Santa Cruz. You know that, don't you?
Well, they try to point this out to me.
They're trying to educate you. They're just trying to help you out so you don't engage in this criminal behavior again and
right.
again.
So he was rather professional and easy about it and just told me, you know, get going. So
get the fuck out of here, buddy, and you'll be all set. You just don't want to see your like around. I think that's a very professional attitude for a Santa Cruz police officer, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. It's always good to hear Winston is moving people along in his professional way. Anything else?
No, that's all. No, anything too negative or anything going on.
Well, so as long as we know how you can scamper along when the police tell you to go, it's always a good thing when Officer Winston comes up with the latest edict, I would say.
Yes, that's true. That's good. I liked what he did.
You wild and crazy guy. Anyway, we've been talking with that beaten down, oppressed individual who's smiling about the whole situation.
Well, yeah, I might as well. There's nothing else I can do.
Well, I can think of a few things, but they would be probably rather negative. What can I say? Again, we've been talking with
Jack Holb.
Thanks, Jack. We're here at the City Hall area. We have some people have already arrived with food. Here's John Valley. John, how's the food?
Food looks delicious, but the issues on the camping, there's like 700 foreclosures in a month in this county, which is really bad. So you got society coming in, and they targeted homeless or camping or your stuff. So if you personally set up a camp or your dwelling space or whatever, they show up with a compactor, steal your stuff, and they're gone. And you got no recourse, no record, except that mine was on the mall, under camera, wheelchair prescribed, oxygen tank hooked up, life support medication in my property, and they gaffled it. I went to the bathroom because the public restroom on Soquel and front by the parking garage was closed. So I came this way, found the restroom at the library, went right back by borders, and my stuff was gone.
Now, when was this?
Three nights. Let's see. Today is Thursday.
Friday night.
Friday night. Then it was
Missouri or someplace?
Tuesday night. And then Wednesday, I'm at the San Lorenzo Park, and I had my stuff, and everybody moved from the beach to the park, and they had all set up. And mine was on the park side, or the grassy side of the redwoods, by the parking lot on the other side of the lawn bowling, and the county or city or whoever got the little lighthouse on their truck, and it was a half-ton white pickup truck with a 30-ton crusher. They threw everything in the back, crushed it to go.
This was on Wednesday.
Yeah.
By what time?
San Lorenzo Park. 7:30 in the morning, 8 o'clock maybe.
And who did this?
I believe it was county workers. They were in a county truck.
And how many were there?
Two.
And
there were three. One stayed in the truck, the driver, a big Mexican and a shorter white guy. I don't know who they were.
Did they give any indication of what authority they were doing?
No, they just said the stuff was abandoned and they were taking it.
This is in direct contradiction to an email sent me by Don Lane and Danette Shoemaker. Lane is the mayor. Shoemaker is the head of Parks and Rec. That Parks and Rec gives property over to the SCPD, the Santa Cruz Police Department, which stores it. Now, I suppose that might be said maybe these are county authorities that are doing this instead of city authorities, since there's this sort of vague jurisdictional fuzzy line and between the county and the city around the county courthouse. So, you know, it could be that the police, the Parks and Rec and up in the Poganip, even though operating with deputies on occasion, I'm told, is doing a store and 90-day interval procedure that is required by state law, and that was recently, as I said, found to be a requirement for even the great and glorious LAPD, who've been using the abandoned property as a pretext for driving homeless people away from Skid Row because they can't use the sitting and the sleeping van anymore.
Whoa, that is a loud ring. I thought we had a softer ring, but...
But in fact, it's not at all clear that that's the case. In fact, what I've heard is that there is still, Parks and Rec is still destroying property. We have a caller, though. Let's see what's up. Hey there, caller. You're on free radio.
Oh, he said the truck had a lighthouse on the side, so that means it's the city.
Oh, okay. So the county has a different set of lights or whatever. Oh, the lighthouse being the insignia. I thought it was sort of like a
right,
tower.
Right, it's the insignia of the city that it's on all the city trucks.
Oh, thank you. Well, apparently the city is helpfully eliminating these pesky homeless survival tents. So,
right.
Or actually, it wasn't. It was a... Well, I'm not sure what it was. He did say it was his oxygen, his medicine, and other bits of personal property that obviously have worth. So it sounds like this sounds actually malicious if Valley's account is correct.
It sounds pretty mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I wasn't there. I didn't see it happen. Valley may be lying, who knows, or exaggerating. But
thank you for everything, Robert.
Sure. Thank you, man. And thanks for calling in. Please, if you got more such corrections or additions, that's the kind of information we need, and call it in. Let's hear some more of what John was saying in this interview from Friday night at the rally.
And at wasn't. They were told who it was, and it was all contained. It wasn't spread out. Or...
Now, you've been keeping a record of the stuff that has been stolen.
Oh, yeah, because I get tickets.
Okay, so did you get a ticket on this occasion?
No, they just stole my property.
Did you get a? Did you make a record of it yourself, of the property?
Yeah, I went over and complained.
And did you complain in writing?
Yeah, in the Sheriff's Department.
And you've got a copy of your complaint?
Yes, sir. And I've also filed a class action lawsuit. I just read over there on the wall, they got the new tickets and what the rules are. And the city, they're concerned about public health. Well, the public health...
These new rules, I'm not sure I've seen them before. And we checked the rules, and they're actually for food providers. But I'm talking now with
Miguel De Leon.
Actually, yeah, it's before we get into Miguel De Leon's interview. And that's an interesting, well, he certainly has had an interesting history. Talk about him in a moment. It's not clear whether it's city or county authorities, although as the caller says, and I believe him, I guess, sounds like it was a city truck. Valley went and complained to the county sheriffs. We need, of course, to be as clear as we can about this, but I think what I would like to see in future protests is perhaps a mechanism for people to actually file complaints about lost property, claims against the city, both for compensatory and punitive damages, under small claims court action. So you don't need a lawyer, and you just subpoena the people into court who are the employees who are doing the destruction of this property and the officials who are mandating it. And, you know, it'd be nice to get lawyers involved. And if there's a lot of real video documentation of people's property being destroyed and people taking responsibility and saying, that's my property you're destroying and I'm making a complaint, which is hard to do. It doesn't seem that hard to do, but we've been finding it hard to do. Huff has given out cameras to people to go and do this. We've, in the past, done a couple of efforts to round this up. We haven't been successful in a clear, organized, and well-documented way yet. But given the latest court decisions, I think, and given the increase in interest, it may be possible to arrange that. And if people are interested in being a part of this kind of a project, I encourage you to start it on your own and do so. And if you want some help from anybody in Huff or other groups, Occupy Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz 11, people who are sympathetic to this whole struggle to restore homeless rights, give a call. You can call Huff at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And, you know, there may be the motivation, the energy, and the organization to actually begin a real significant pushback on a number of fields, not just direct action, which I think is really important, but also in the courts, which it's possible that local authorities will take that one even more seriously if we actually get a serious effort. Though I have to say that even the $2.3 million settlement in Fresno in the Kincaid case for essentially destruction of homeless property in violation of state law and the federal constitution has not stopped the police from new actions destroying homeless encampments and moving them around, as you may remember if you've heard reports on this program from Mike Rhodes, who's a Fresno Community Alliance activist who calls in with reports every few months at my request. So, yeah, I mean, these are ideas for future protests and future rallies. I think it's... the more power you amass and the more I think you push, the greater the chance that you're going to be regarded as a credible force, both by other people who are potential allies but afraid to get involved for fear that they're going to be part of a movement that isn't really going anywhere. And also, it will have the impact on the politicians who at least have to make some gestures toward you, if nothing else. And it also provides a middle ground for slippery liberals who want to sort of slip in with mediating on both sides kinds of solutions, which really are a way of dampening down the pressure, but sometimes cause some small advances and sometimes some significant advances. It's hard to see that has been the case in Santa Cruz. don't know if I can credibly speak for 30-year history of San Francisco or Berkeley, which are two other localities where there's been a lot of struggle against the same kind of laws. Don't sit on the sidewalk. Don't sleep at night. Don't put your property down. Keep walking. But, well, let's hear more.
And Miguel de Leon, a.k.a. Lito, anything recently happened? You said they got me good, is what you just said.
Oh, yeah, they swooped me up at the drum circle and arrested me supposedly for 9 unpaid tickets and for 3 no-shows to court. For those tickets, which, you know, who knows when I got so many.
When was this arrest?
Probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the judge was giving me 48 days. And
you just got out, or you actually have yet to serve it?
Well, he put a stay away order on me for 2 years to stay away from the Ave, from the
Levee, Pacific Avenue.
Yeah, Pacific Avenue, the Levee, and San Lorenzo Park, which are all my homes. You know, since they put that injunction on me now, it's okay. They can put whatever court order they want on me. And
this was not done, though, pursuant to the injunction. It was done because of supposedly the unpaid tickets, or did you plead guilty to that? Or?
No contest.
Yeah, similar. So they do they offer you jail instead of probation?
They have 48 days hanging over my head. If I get caught anywhere home, I get 48 days in jail. When right before me, a guy who did some heinous crimes got less time than I did.
What did he do?
Well, he stole a car and robbed some lady or some shit, you know? Violent crime, even. And he got less time than I did.
And so you have the stay order for how long? 48 days or for 2 years?
2 years.
So
everywhere I work, everywhere I live. You know what I'm saying?
And so you are at City Hall, which means you are legal here because you're not on Pacific Avenue.
Not on Pacific Avenue.
Now, does it extend a block out? How far does it extend?
As far as I know, just on the block. But it's pretty hard to get anywhere in Santa Cruz without at least crossing it.
Yeah.
You know? So I do chance it every day, trying to shoot across it, you know.
So, now you've admitted, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take you into custody. But I'm too busy now with fighting with Brent about my sign, so we won't get into that at this time. Anyway, thank you.
Yep.
And it should be noted that this is Miguel de Leon, also known as Lito, who, along with his former partner, Anna Richardson, were the subject of a real massive city effort to criminalize them as a couple downtown through the so-called civil injunction process. That happened 3 years ago, I think. And the courts were reluctant to ban them from downtown because they hadn't been convicted of any crimes. Instead, they did pass an injunction, a temporary restraining order, and then I think a preliminary injunction that said something like, they can't violate any laws when they're downtown, or they will be charged with a misdemeanor. The kind of laws that they were accused of violating were things like, mainly they were camping laws, sleeping. Some of them were sitting laws, and there were a few far-fetched laws, like far-fetched cases, like bathing in the fountain, where at one point I think we had one instance of Anna rinsing out one of her some cloth in the town fountain some years ago. But generally speaking, my understanding, and although these two are very outspoken and that was their main crime, they wouldn't leave. They continued to resist by being downtown. And as you can see, Lito he openly admits he asked to cross Pacific Avenue, and now even though the injunction really failed to criminalize them downtown, didn't drive them away. It just made it so that the cops would follow them around and look for anything they could arrest them on. And apparently they found some stuff for Lito, and he didn't get to court on these tickets, and that became a crime. I'm not sure whether that was under the new three infractions and you get a misdemeanor if you don't get to court law passed by Mayor Lane's council some years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, or whether it was simply just a series of infractions that many infractions in the city code are so that if you have a second infraction within a brief period of time, sometimes even a longer period of time, like 6 months, which is true, for example, for panhandling. It is a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. It sounds like they're minor infractions, though, because he said 48 days. So that means that rather than serve 48 days in jail, he agreed to take 2 years probation, which meant a stay-away order from this entire area, which is pretty outrageous. Usually, you know, you get a stay-away order from Long's if you've stolen something, or you get a stay-away order from, you know, the place that you supposedly committed your crime at. By Long's, of course, I'm referring now to CVS, but those are the old days for me. But that's not what they did here. They made a massive, broad stay-away order for him. And to his credit, he still joined this protest. And I don't know whether he was a part of the protest when we crossed Pacific Avenue and went down Pacific Avenue. I honestly don't. I didn't notice one way or the other. But hats off to Lido for essentially standing up for his right to be for political expression, regardless of the attempts of the authorities to get rid of him. And I'm not just talking political expression on this one vigil, this one little, one impressive symbolic vigil that we had. And I say it's a little vigil in the sense that it takes up a relatively short amount of time and space compared with the lives of people every day who are getting hassled. But Lido has said that he continues to try to be a part of the Santa Cruz community in spite of the unconstitutional restrictions that are being thrown down against him. And that is a much bolder, more persistent, and frankly, more politically active stance than anything any of us did by holding up signs and walking around with candles. And yeah, I kind of diminish that and poo-poo it a little bit, but I also commend it. I think candlelight vigils are good. This was a good vigil. It had more people in a relatively short period of time than... I wasn't sure what to expect myself, but, you know, certainly it's a goodly number of people. And hats off to the people who came and to organizer Brent Adams for the work done to get this vigil going.
These cats, you know, they really, really need to pull their head out of their ass so they don't have such a shitty view anymore.
Nicely put. We've been talking with...
Oh, it's nobody.
Miguel de Leon.
Yeah.
So it's about 7:10. You're blocking the street again. All right, that's better.
And this actually is something that's interesting. It showed a difference of style. There was a police car parked legally and properly in a parking spot right next to the side entrance on Church Street to City Hall. It's kind of right across from the Civic Auditorium parking lot. And there was a second police car parked, stopped in the street next to it, blocking the lane of traffic. And two police officers were out there kind of schmoozing and chatting with officers in the other car. And this is what I noticed when I came up Friday night. I saw this happening. And as I often do when I see police doing this and there's no evident crime happening, it seems simply to be a sort of a naked and arrogant assertion of police privilege, I took them to task, like you heard me saying, you know, what are you doing in the street? Taxpayer money here. Other people can't do what you're doing. Get to work or else at least get out of the street so you're not, you know, so demonstrably showing that you can do whatever you want that ordinary citizens can't. And also blocking traffic, you know, making it more difficult for people to get past. Something that we would get tickets for if we did it. Unless you have some specific legitimate reason for being here right now. That is usually what the force of what I say when I come up against this kind of situation with people with uniforms and guns and badges and so forth. I mean, I admit, because of the focus that police have on poor and homeless people, I'm initially somewhat suspicious of police when I see them downtown. Although I'm sure in many cases they have a legitimate function there in the sense that they are supposedly investigating crimes of violence or theft. Or real problems, perhaps. Maybe they're giving some traffic instructions, you know, helping to direct traffic. I mean, there's some legitimate purposes that we all have that we can agree on. Harassing homeless people, enforcing merchant-generated downtown ordinances that deny people basic rights is not one of them. Anyway, the the officers sort of ignored me, and they were sort of, you know, making jokes back and forth. And I continued to say, why are you in the middle of the street? What's the reason you're here? I kept saying that. And Brent Adams, who has this protest, who really was, as I was commending for doing this protest, and I, again, continued to say that, had a wholly different stance. He didn't want me to offend the police department. He apparently had worked out some kind of understanding that everyone would be gone by 10 o'clock because there's a rule that there is nobody allowed at City Hall on the grounds after 10 o'clock. That is a law. That is, of course, an inappropriate law that was not even a law. It was an edict made by the head of Parks and Rec in order to eliminate people who were doing a protest 2 years ago, Peace Camp 2010, just as a more recent curfew set up at the county building was cooked up by the chief administrative officer, Susan Mariello, there to eliminate or make it more difficult or more intimidating for Occupy Santa Cruz activists who were spending the night there. I mean, there are laws they can try to use to criminalize people at night that don't involve setting up curfews, but they decided to put icing on the cake and set up curfews both at City Hall and at the county building and the court building, as well as at the library, for that matter. And, of course, there's been a long-time curfew on the levee and in the parks. So Brent Adams, who is really taking a lot of risks in organizing a protest like this, because he is one of the Santa Cruz 11, and he could be jailed as a violation of his OR condition, as could I, as could a bunch of other people, for simply being in a political protest if the police decide to squint at us wrong and claim we are not obeying all laws. You know, we probably could successfully fight it in court after some time in court and maybe some time in jail. But it requires some cojones to proceed and some enthusiasm and some beliefs. And I want to salute everybody in the Santa Cruz 11. And that would include Leto, who's not in the Santa Cruz 11. We just heard from him, who are standing up on these issues at the risk, to some extent, of their liberty being taken away. On the other hand, Brent and I really have a difference of opinion on how to deal with the police. Although Brent has had some outspoken encounters with the police, which have kind of made me anxious for his safety when he stood up for the activists at Peace Camp 2010. But in this particular occasion, his perspective was we shouldn't offend the police. And my perspective is kind of a pretty consistent, no, it's more important to model for people that the police are not to be given special privileges and powers. They are to be held to account for what they do wherever we happen to be, insofar as we can do so. And there really is a sort of a difference of opinion there. Similarly, with respect to staying after 10 o'clock at the City Hall, we did actually stay after 10 o'clock to some extent. There were some cops hanging around. They didn't do anything. They don't want to probably engage in the paperwork. And there is a real First Amendment issue. I mean, this is that center of government, the idea that you can't be there after a certain hour because what? Because they want to, it's unclear. This whole thing was brought up like 15 years ago when the then Mayor Mike Rotkin tried to go to court to ban demonstrations at night. He was not successful. So instead, this was done in an underhanded process by Danette Shoemaker in consultation with Chief Vogel and then Mayor Ryan, I don't know if it was Ryan Coon, I think it was Cynthia Matthews at the time in 2010. Yeah, I think so. And so there were some people, I was told, who wanted to set up a voter registration table on the City Hall grounds at 10:05 and start registering voters from among the people who are still at the protest. And if they wanted to, police want to come in and try to mess with a voter registrar at 10:05 at night, let them do it. I thought that was a great idea, although I was only informed about it afterward. But apparently it was in some way deterred by the sort of very closely regulated, Brent tried to really very kind of tightly regulate this protest. He tried to move it along, cut short speaking time, although he did also try to give people chances to speak. It was done all within these very narrow confines of a legal protest that couldn't possibly be construed as illegal. Although we walked down Pacific Avenue, we violated perhaps traffic regulations, though it's frequent on protests in Santa Cruz that people walk in the street, and that's just considered part of the First Amendment often here, particularly if you have a large enough group.
So there are differences of strategy and differences of opinion on how to proceed on these things. And let's hear some more about what was going on Friday night at City Hall and then throughout the town to protect the rights of poor and homeless people.
Squad car moves on from its double park position. So earlier there were the two squad cars, again, one parked, one double parked next to the squad car on Church Street, right adjacent to the side entrance to City Council, blocking the road. Looks like more people are showing up here. Please did move away quickly when I raise my voice.
That was interesting. I just want to add, the first time I tried this, come on, officers, get out of the road. There's nothing going on. It's no time for you to do a coffee clutch in the middle of the street. We can't do it. You shouldn't do it. They sort of ignored it the first time. The second time I came back and did it when there was, they did it again. They actually did move eventually after a few minutes when I arrived around 6:45. The second time was like around 7:45 or 8, and they were the same place doing the same thing, and it was the same officers. Cars parked side by side. Shortly, I mean, within 5 seconds after I began shouting from a distance, "What are you doing in the middle of the street again?" they moved. And I think it shows that people can learn, people can be trained, even people who are in armed and with guns, badges, and so-called legal authority will respond when the eyes of the community are upon them, even if it's only one set of eyes, but somebody with a voice and eyes and a large crowd not too far away, and they know they're doing something that is really, they're assuming that the community will accept that because, after all, they're the law. But when it comes clear that some people in the community won't accept it and there may be others who will follow that lead, then they begin to respond, I think, to what needs to be a proportionate understanding of what their real role is, at least not to so arrogantly assert that they have the right to do all kinds of things that ordinary people can't do just because they're guys in uniforms with badges and guns.
So I'm here at about 8:22. We're talking with that woman about food.
Jean Carano.
Jean, what's your... It looks like the more people are showing up. I'm counting 10, 20, 30, 50 or 60 people at least.
That's close to 40 to 50 maybe. I can tell by what I cooked.
How much... Is all your food gone almost?
Pretty good, yeah.
So it's actually... it's a reasonable size crowd.
Yeah.
We had a little police come through and say hi and then take off.
Yeah.
They spoke with Brent, and then we're on their way. Brent has a illegal bullhorn, which is hopefully will not be. I don't know if it's illegal. It's as far as I've heard, it's quite appropriate. And we have a sign, "How's the homeless, not the warriors? Justice before sports."
Where's the outrage?
Look at this. Now, what's right? It's an economic engine to support
that.
The homeless, the Warriors Stadium.
Well, if they did allocate some of the funds that are raised by the Warriors being in town, or then that would make sense, devote some of the proceeds to homeless services.
Well, I'm sure that John Lane will take care of that.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to.
He's going to help out on that one. I'm sure. And Steve Plaich, once he's elected, I'm sure.
Well, now there's something else again. I'm all for Steve.
But it takes time and money. Sometime down the road, we'll talk about that.
In the meantime,
go Warriors.
Forward march, said the general as the army retreated.
Yeah, it's nicely put. Drone on, as they say.
And apropos the proposal, it's coming up at City Council at night, day after tomorrow, at 7 o'clock in the evening session, for those of you who are masochists or determined council attenders. There is a proposal to throw millions after millions into the Warriors Stadium. Becky Johnson has written something about this, and I'm going to try to bring it up if I can get this computer to respond. And let's see if we can do that. Becky Johnson, as most listeners know, is one of the Santa Cruz 11 and also a longtime activist. In their own blog, Becky Johnson, onewomantalking.blogspot.com, she writes, "With a name like North Dakota Wizards, what could go wrong?
$4.2 million loan to a for-profit professional sports entertainment franchise, while a burgeoning local homeless population is given the boot and a bus ticket out of town, by Becky Johnson. This was written yesterday. Santa Cruz, California. With a name like North Dakota Wizards, what could go wrong? The city of Santa Cruz has decided to use a parking lot, currently used for Seaside County employee parking, for a temporary sports stadium to house a feeder basketball franchise in downtown Santa Cruz. And they plan to spend $4.1 million of city money to do it, a clear example of charity to the rich. Just last April, it was $2.5 million to $3 million. Apparently, it's gone up. They are considering using 225 underused permit parking spaces, unquote, if there is such a thing, for the Seaside Company employee parking and the shuttle as transportation to work. So Santa Cruz, all the fluff and cosmetics of antique trolley shuttles for 25 cents carrying workers to jobs that don't pay the rent, don't provide any benefits, and don't go anywhere. A primary employer of youth, they brag, but few Seaside Company jobs are good jobs. None are unionized jobs. And remind me again why we are subsidizing the Seaside Company at all. With a homeless population 22% higher than just 2 years ago, I think that's way underestimated, services are severely impacted. Calvary Episcopal, also known as the Red Church downtown, fed a record 188 people on Monday, August 27th. Yet City Council leaders Ryan Coonerty, Hillary Bryant, and Lynn Robinson have vowed that the only new services for homeless that they are willing to provide is a bus ticket out of town. Failing to respond to leaders as obvious public health emergency, the city did just the opposite. The Santa Cruz Police Department, the Parks and Rec Department, and the Public Works Department teamed up to sweep parks, green belts, and riverbanks in order to remove encampments, issue citations, and to make arrests of homeless people for the crimes of sleeping, camping, lodging, or trespass on public property. Former city council member and former mayor Cynthia Matthews, also running again, knows the Red Church and Father Joel Miller well. She has been defrocking priests since 2009. Matthews, who owns the historical Zazu Pitts home on Lincoln Street, which is one right next between the Nickelodeon and the hamburger joint on the corner, took such issue, as this is Cynthia Matthews, former mayor, now running again, took such issue with Joel Miller's ministry to the downtown homeless wayfarers that she issued a letter on city letterhead stationery, no less, seeking to get the pastor fired. After an arduous and expensive process, Miller kept his job and the homeless kept their once-a-week meal. And, in fact, Miller and a few other churches have been expanding or establishing a very small emergency shelter program that some folks have gotten into, including Andrea Morgan, for 4 days a week or four nights a week. But it's very, very limited. Move Along Matthews, as we had called her, for her advocacy for the non-commercial display device ordinance, aimed at political tables, allowed only 1 hour's time at any location on Pacific Avenue out of a 24-hour period in which free speech could take place. Maybe we should call her No Time, No Place, and No Manner Matthews. She also prevented the Planned Parenthood Westside Health Clinic from unionizing when she was its executive director. All this is to say that the city has its priorities all backwards. It is subsidizing the rich and stealing from the poor. The Coonerty Robinson Bryant plan is to use city money to finance a for-profit venture that may or may not pay off financially for the city, but which will certainly pay handsomely for Lynn, Hill, and Ryan's friends. And while construction might involve new jobs, none of these will be union jobs. Our tiny organization, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, took a stand on this last spring. Huff passed a resolution saying we did not oppose the sports stadium being built, but opposed the use of any city funding. I mean, if it's a profitable venture, then investors should be lining up, right? Well, the excitement of a sports stadium pitched back in April claimed fans would relish the opportunity to attend a Warriors event. What worries me is that the city is already in financial trouble, and city manager Martine Bernal is not making me feel any better. This isn't a money-making scheme for the city, he says. If the city is investing $4.1 million, it better be a money-making scheme. Of course, it's not his money. It's ours, or it was ours. And then Becky quotes an article in the Santa Cruz Sentinel by J.M. Brown. Santa Cruz Warriors up investment and relocation deal. City Council vote expected Tuesday.
Santa Cruz. Ahead of a critical city council vote Tuesday, the Golden State Warriors Development League team has agreed to strengthen its investments in a $5.4 million seven-year deal with the city to relocate this fall. According to restructured financial terms revealed Friday, the Santa Cruz Warriors will prepay 4 years of rent on a temporary 30,000-square-foot arena to be built between downtown and the beach. The city will use the $532,000 to pay down a city loan underwriting the fast-track project. Just a week ago, the team had agreed to pay a full 7 years of rent at $133,000 per year, but city negotiators decided to credit the team for 3 years of rent if the Warriors increase their capital investment from $600,000 to $1.4 million. That money is separate from the loan. I'm not familiar with the significance of this. If anybody is who wants to call in and talk about it, please do so. City Manager Martine Bernal said the new agreement reduces the city's overall risk by increasing security on the loan, the amount of which has nearly doubled since the team first publicly announced its relocation plans in April. Receiving 4 years of rent up front, in addition to collecting annual loan payments of $250,000, better secures the city's investment, he said. In case we had a worst-case scenario and the Warriors decided to leave and default on the loan, what we wanted to have was more collateral, Bernal said. It doesn't sound like enough collateral, however, to cover the loan. The team, formerly called the North Dakota Wizards, hopes to host its first home game in late December in a facility constructed on an employee parking lot belonging to the Santa Cruz Seaside Company, which owns the tourist magnet Beach Boardwalk nearby. The facility at 140 Front Street will have 2,950 seats for games, and when floor seats are added, 4,000 for concerts or other events. Complex new deal. City and team officials said there is a tentative deal with the Seaside Company to relocate Boardwalk employee parking to 220 spaces in downtown garages with underused permit capacity and provide shuttles to the beach. The Warriors will also make $35,000 in annual lease payments to the Seaside Company and paint a Boardwalk logo on the arena floor 6 feet wide from center court, a sponsorship the team values at $50,000. So that means 220 less parking spaces for visitors, residents, but more benefits for the Seaside Company's underpaid workers. As for collateral, the Warriors agreed to pay to cover $529,000 in prepaid construction expenses if the city releases loan funds over time to cover those costs while the team pays down the overall loan. As the facility's owner, the city agreed to credit the Warriors $1.85 million for the value of the leasehold interest, the city's share of a Kaiser Permanente naming rights deal and assets within the facility. And it begins to lose me, and may be losing you too there. So all of you financial wizards out there, even the North Dakota Wizards, perhaps can give a call in at 427-3772 to explain. Let me know what's cut through the verbiage. Here's a little more for the story, though, because this is an event. The vote at City Council comes up Tuesday night. For those of you who want to just say no to that, that's 7 o'clock downtown City Hall, Council Chambers, across from the main library in the Civic Auditorium. With the expedited rent payment schedule, that brings to $2.9 million the amount the city views as collateral against its $4.1 million loan from a public trust fund. That fund, created by the sale of property, can only be used for capital investments and contains only $6.1 million as of June, just a third more than the Warriors' loan. So they're gambling the whole thing on that. They're saying that at least they're gambling $1.1 million on this, because that's not going to be covered by the difference from the $2.9 million supposedly collateral and the $4.1 million loan the city is taking out. By shifting rent payments from the back end of the lease to prepayment, by acknowledging some money we have already expended and not requiring the city to fully extend the loan amount, I personally thought that this was a better way to structure it, said Jim Wireman, president of the Santa Cruz Warriors, or is it the North Dakota Wizards? I tried to respond to reduce the overall perceived at-risk position of the city, though my personal view is that the money is not at risk. Everything's going to be okay, folks. Original estimates for the facility were $2.8 million, but sandy soil, fire safety requirements, and other construction-related issues necessitated a sturdier structure than originally planned, all of which raised the costs to 5.4 million, which, of course, is almost twice as much. The facility would come down in 7 years unless the team and the city agree to extend the arrangement while pursuing a permanent structure. So you're getting a sturdier structure for $5.4 million, but not a permanent structure. This sounds worse and worse to me, folks. There is no change in the city's intent to collect concessions revenue, including from wine and beer sales, and apply it to the loan. Revenue from renting the area out for the UC Santa Cruz sports teams, concerts, or other events will also go towards retiring the debt. And a couple of the critics' comments that I heard in the last few days was, wasn't this going to badly impact local merchants who could be getting business who are selling booze, for those of you who are big fans of the booze sellers? Or alternately, doesn't this take away revenue from the Civic Auditorium? And I don't know. It's just a concern that was raised. If debt on the loan remains after 7 years, the city has agreed to split it with the team. The minimum the city can hope for is repayment, but there is a possibility for the city to make money. No. The minimum the city can hope for is a default and a loss of $1.1 million, according to what I've heard. But, again, what do I know about finances? The minimum the city can hope for, writes J.M. Brown in the Sentinel, is repayment. But there is the possibility for the city to make money on a separate admissions tax, any increases in hotel and sales taxes, and sharing in merchandise and ticket sales once the loan is repaid. Still, Brunel said, this isn't a money-making scheme for the city. The goal is to see whether we can have a better, more modern facility to revitalize this area and see if we can create a connection between the downtown and the beach area by shuttling seaside employees back and forth from their 225 parking spots, I see. This could catalyze that. There is another minor change separate from the loan. The city will defer general plan and water and sewage fees of $147,000 with the expectation that a $1 facility use surcharge added to each ticket will cover that. As is usual for publicly owned facilities, Brunel said the venue would be exempt from traffic impact fees, which could total up to $1 million. So it sounds like another $1.1 million giveaway there as well. Noise, parking concerns. Even if council members agree to the new financial terms, they must okay a special use permit for the property, which is zoned multifamily residential. The council will hear concerns from Beach Hill neighbors over noise, parking, and traffic created by the team's 24 annual games and other events. The city's Planning Commission board heard these complaints Thursday before voting unanimously to recommend approval of the project, which could mean it's a great project and all my concerns and those of others have been expressed are really addressable or not significant or overruled by benefits. Or it could mean that the Planning Commission has a lot of political pressure on it. It's appointed by the same people who want this rammed through the City Council, the Coonerty majority. It's hard to say what's going on. I have not been following closely the Planning Commission's makeup and its other recent votes. The Commission underlined the importance of key conditions that the team encourage parking in downtown lots or on-street spaces, that Beach Hill residents get the option of year-round parking permits, and that noise be monitored by the city. We absolutely want them to park downtown, Wireman said. If we can't park people and get them in and out, they won't come back. Wireman, again, is the Wizards Warriors guy, or the Wizard of the Warriors. He said the team will promote off-site parking through the internet, advertising, and direct mail to season ticket holders, and possibly provide face painters, balloon makers, or street musicians to create a Disney-like entrance that makes the walk toward the arena more pleasant. Better get rid of them homeless people nearby, too. You don't want anything to spoil it for them guys. And that, of course, is really a concern that hasn't been discussed at all. When the Steinbeck Center was created in Salinas, the next thing they did was start sweeping the area for homeless people and getting rid of them. It's as happens before Olympics in the major cities where it's been held. You get this massive gentrification effort that goes on. And that's a concern when you have a city that is already city government and city staff and city police that are committed to homeless eradication or minimization or out of sight, out of mindishness. Noise will be reduced by insulated metal walls, and fans must be out by 10 p.m. Good luck with that. Richard Andrews, former president of the Beech Hill Neighborhood Association and the City Parks and Recreation Commissioner, said he felt the Planning Commission listened to citizen concerns, but many are still worried about noise. I think the neighbors are very suspicious of the whole project, Andrews said, adding they expect to report rowdy fans. Some of us feel we're going to have to go through that process. You notice there are no critics of this plan even interviewed or quoted from in this article by J.M. Brown. So it is a PR, although it's kind of an informative PR, if assuming it's accurate, which I have no idea, really, by a piece by J.M. Brown of the Sentinel, which is kind of how he goes. 7 p.m. City Council Tuesday is where you get the chance to watch this circus proceed. And somebody wrote, Dakota Wizards, not North Dakota Wizards. Well, hats off to Becky Johnson and her blog, Becky Johnson, onewomantalking.blogspot.com, for bringing this issue to my attention and to our attention, although it's in the headlines of the Santa Cruz Urinal, or Sentinel, as some would call it. Let's go musical for a minute, and maybe some of you will decide you want to give us your thoughts on this whole situation, how it impacts the homeless community, renters, people generally, or discuss some of the other stuff that's been brought up on the show. 427-3772 is the call-in number here, 427-3772.
Yeah.
turn makes me feeble and as silent as a ghost. I try to call my brain for answers, but I get this mocking glow that says you got yourself the body of a man, but you got boots throw. Tight is ever rising. I can hear it with my stethoscope. I'm supposed to build a net, but I got barbed wire rope. I've been fishing with the blunt end of a rotten cantaloupe, and all the catfish swear with their last breath of air that I got a booze throw. Too low to take off my head, but to my surprise I ducked in time and it hit the wall instead. And it said you got too much fight, better find yourself designed to die before you lose control. Oh, you're gonna lose control. Oh, you're gonna lose control. Oh, my friend, I've lost. Have you seen my beak and my wings and heard me sing in the morning? Whoa.
That was two more from Vinton Tiger, Oregon Yard, and Bird's Throat. Got an echo there. Not sure what that's about. So you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, in case you just tuned in. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. And we've been talking about a variety of issues, at least somewhat related to homeless civil rights or lack thereof. Most recently, we were talking about the Tuesday City Council meeting where there's going to be a 7 o'clock discussion of the, well, probably a rubber stamping of the Wizards Warriors $4.1 million boondoggle being proposed. That's, I guess, my decision at the moment as to what it's all about, to as a city's redevelopment-ish type opportunity in the Beach Flats area, I guess we're talking. There's some discussion about it on the Sentinel website as well, which I haven't gotten into. I was curious if there was actually any critics who actually wanted to challenge anything that was being said. I don't know if there actually is such a thing, but I'm going to move on from that topic and raise another one that came up recently in Royal Oaks. Royal Oaks is a suburb or a small town, actually, in Monterey County. I think it's near Salinas. I'm not sure if it's south, north, east, or west of Salinas, but it has been the site of a foreclosure fight, a fight against foreclosure, actually. And the Sentinel has been covering it. It's done three stories this week. The most recent story out of Watsonville is, let's see here. Well, it's over here. The most recent story, Royal Oak couple evicted from foreclosed home again, Royal Oaks. Ed and Brandy Hannon were evicted for a second time Friday from the Tuckahoe Terrace home they lost to foreclosure last year. Brandy Hannon said her husband left the home at the request of Monterey County deputies who showed up with a bank official at about 10 a.m. Boy, it sounds like the 30s. Brandy was at home at Monterey at the time Randy said they are staying with a relative and that she doesn't know what the next move might be, although she's not giving up. She said a bank official told her how to make an appointment within 15 days to retrieve the family's possessions. She said Wells Fargo has posted a round-the-clock private security guard at the home. I guess when they're not building barbed wire fences around vacant bank buildings in Santa Cruz, they're posting guards to make sure that people don't go back to their homes. The Hannons were initially evicted August 29th, but reoccupied the house they had owned for 14 years last weekend in hopes of persuading Wells Fargo to reconsider their situation. They said Ed's health problems caused a financial hardship that led to the foreclosure. Hannon, a type 1 diabetic, suffered kidney failure 4 years ago and is waiting for a transplant. The Wells Fargo spokesman said the bank tried to work with the Hammonds to keep them in the home, but was unable to find a resolution and foreclosed in June 2011. The eviction was postponed three times to enable the Hannons to find housing, he said. And Brandy Hannon writes on the website, treatments are expensive, prosthetic legs are expensive, eye surgeries to try and halt diabetic retinopathy are expensive, prescriptions that run into thousands for a month. Maybe people would prefer that anyone else in my husband's shoes lie about their assets and go on Medi-Cal, maybe get some food stamps, hit up Catholic Charities or the Community Action Board to pay for utilities. I didn't ask for a principal reduction. We could pay what we owe if Wells Fargo would just work with us until September 2013. All I asked was a reduction in payments for a fixed amount of time as we exhausted resources paying medical bills for the period of time we were uninsured. Dialysis treatment, $1,900 average. I hope that none of you have to find out. And somebody asks, Brandy, did you provide all the details of your mortgage, loans, lottery winnings, employment, and medical insurance history to Donna Jones? If not, her bad for writing this without the facts. If so, her bad for not including them. Overall, editor is bad for publishing this. Since you seem to continue to want to defend yourself in such a public way, why not provide the details? And there's more on this website. Again, mostly when I read these comments, it's from hostile trolls who are supporting authorities. But in this case, I'm glad to read they're not. Brandy and Ed, I do not know you, writes Robin Rebecca Rhodes, but please know I will keep you in my prayers for a kidney transplant to be found soon. I'm glad relatives have offered you a roof over your head as you continue to deal with this foreclosure. I once wrote a blog story titled A Roof Over My Head about my own loss of nearly everything. My dream rental housing, two pets due to illness, my car due to not being able to afford to buy a new engine. And I thought, what's left now? What's still here? And then I thought, I'm still here. Sentinel, what is your position on Donna Jones' reporting? Donna Jones is the writer of the story I read. Until comments on this, she queried the circumstances and financial facts of the story. She was merely a shill for this couple's desires. So this is actually a critic of this couple. Her second try reported some facts about the purchase and refinancing of the house, as well as the lottery win. There are other questions and unreported details that a professional journalist would have asked and confirmed before bringing a story like this to an editor. And what kind of editor approves such a tale, lacking details and facts and swimming in sympathy? I kind of like that. Of course, you know, I have my feelings about Wells Fargo. As noted below, she even leaves out the important details in today's follow-up. Is this acceptable to your newspaper's journalistic standards? Joshua Epstein responds, for the people crying any crocodile tears for Wells Fargo, here are some facts. Wells Fargo has done the following. 1. Knowingly sold toxic mortgage-based securities. 2. Foreclosure fraud. 3. Predatory lending. 4. Bid rigging. 5. Insider trading. 6. Loan application fraud. 7. High-frequency trading. 8. Front-running markets. 9. Even drug money laundering, for God's sake. How many crimes are you people going to let Wells Fargo get away with? Time for a little perspective. And a frequent right-wing critic on this website says, Wells Fargo can do all sorts of bad things. That doesn't mean they did anything bad here. You cheated on your taxes. That doesn't mean you robbed the store down the street. And another person writes, I'd be surprised if Wells Fargo didn't get possession of their loan when they took over the failing Wachovia, which was done at the behest of the FDIC so that it wouldn't have to shut down the institution. Wachovia had acquired Golden West Financial, parent corporation of World Savings. The latter was an early pioneer in option payment loans and later became a driver of bad underwriting. Wells Fargo itself was far more prudent in its own lending. Steve Douglas writes, I don't see anyone shedding tears for Wells Fargo, nor should they. Wells Fargo will not lose money over this. The mortgage is most likely guaranteed by the federal government, so the taxpayers will lose out. If that doesn't work, Wells Fargo will just raise fees and rates so the customers will cover the loss. It's easy to say let the big corporations take the loss, but that isn't how things work. And one of the critics of the couple who are being foreclosed on writes, acknowledging the facts isn't negativity. They pulled a bunch of money out of their bubble-inflated house using a very flexible and expensive loan, and now that the money is gone, and so is the house. Not negative, just truth. The subject has chimed in and not disputed any of the posted facts. If the subjects want to enlist our support for their situation, it's reasonable that we know the full situation, not just the parts that sound good. To which a defender of the couple writes, nice empathy, everyone. Until you have a major illness and lose everything due to cost-incurred illness, you have no right to judge. About a hard-headed Wells Fargo defender, perhaps, says, I have lots of empathy. Problem is that the couple took out a $600,000 loan on the house before the illness. If they wouldn't have taken that money, I'm sure they would still be in their house today. They took out at least $300,000 from the house in 2006, 2 years before the illness. We have no idea how that was spent. Did it sit in the bank waiting for him to get sick 2 years later? Not likely. I have sympathy for the medical condition, but that didn't cause them to take out an option ARM and pay 3% of the 7% interest and so forth. This gets pretty technical. You know, it's such a technical subject, and one which I wish I could more authoritatively give thoughts other than essentially pass on my understanding that Wells Fargo nationally has done all kinds of foreclosure fraud, and even in the state of California. And I've been pushing for activists and local authorities to actually audit the foreclosure activity of Wells Fargo locally, robo-signings, what they do in terms of mixing and matching their loan actions with their foreclosure process. And although there's some protection that is being provided as of January, I think statewide there was a bill that was passed, I'm not aware the conditions are any better than they were a year ago when the Occupy movement started. And that became one of the large, and I understand legitimate concerns of the Occupy movement, but it is important to answer these critics. And I encourage people who know more about this issue, who want to talk about it, call in. 427-3772 is the call-in number here on Free Radio. And do call in. And now, getting back into territory that's a little more familiar, here's some more from the Friday Vigil and some more interviews of folks who were carrying candles and Dixie cups and signs and walking the streets. Making signs as well. It was good in that regard. There was somewhat tight control of the protest. The leader of the protest didn't want any signs about the Santa Cruz 11. He didn't want any signs about, the issues of, there was a third group, I guess, nothing regarding, I guess, broader criminalization issues, perhaps, other than the sleeping ban, kind of a particular focus on that in the forbidden zones, which I think is an important focus for sure. I always get really antsy, though, when people try to really closely control First Amendment rights and protests. It becomes difficult for me. But I'm glad we had the protest. I'm looking forward to another one. I'm only sort of sorry we didn't plan something for Tuesday, because really the people who are controlling the sweeps and the police department and the Parks and Rec, under the city manager's direction, Martine Bernal, they need to be confronted during the day when there's people in the offices that have to listen to what they have to say, take their complaints and concerns, and hopefully that'll be happening in the next few weeks.
Talking with
Janet O'Brien.
Janet, you've made a sign that says sleeping is not a crime. How did you hear about this protest?
Well, people I work with at the Homeless Garden Project were talking about it, and then I saw the flyers around town.
Great, so you came down?
Yeah.
And who is this with you?
This is my housemate, and I'm her helper. This is Virginia.
Yeah.
Hey, Virginia. What do you think of the protest?
It's wonderful. I'm glad it's really going on. We need more people out here to support the homeless. They need a place to live. We don't need warrior. We don't need any games down here. Somebody helping these people, not them.
I agree with you.
The more power we can get, the better to us.
What's that?
The more power we can get to us.
More power, the better, I'm afraid. That's what we need now. And what's your name, sir?
My name is Danny. I work at the Homeless Garden Project. That's all I really have to say, but I hope this is a really peaceful night. It seems like it's been a peaceful day, so it's going to keep on going.
I understand Mayor Don Lane might be here, except that there's a candidate for him. But Steve Plaich is here, and there's a candidate for him.
You know, I met Mayor Don Lane. I'm not impressed with his stance on the homeless situation because he hasn't done nothing. I mean, it's just that simple. It's time for him to move on if he's not going to do anything. So
I'm afraid you're right.
Maybe we should just go occupy his house.
Or at least his front yard, maybe the sidewalk in front of his house, in case we want to avoid arrest for trespass.
Well, maybe we should arrest him for trespassing on our land.
Or on our rights.
Right, that too.
Or on the human dignity of a whole class of people by remaining silent as the Gestapo moves forward.
Well, it's really disgusting what his leadership has led the city to do to old, disabled women and men, and even women. What goes on to them on the streets is just unbelievable. And if they can't even find a safe tent to sleep in, how are they going to protect themselves from the muggings, the rapes, and what else goes on with them? It's like ridiculous. The police are supposed to protect and serve, not beat the hell out of us.
Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
So, and Brent is. Brent is.
We are going to have a word from Father Steve from the Circle Church just before we leave. But we'll have a word. We'll share what's going to happen just before that. I just want to let you know that to line up and start grabbing some candles. Thank you. I don't know if I want to give you one.
And so Brent is announcing the candles for the candlelight vigil. And I thought this would be some sort of a consensus event, but I guess not. It's more of a Brent event. But that's okay. It's a sleeping band event. And so candles are being lit. Grab a candle. We're talking with Steve Plaich, city council candidate, and also a man who was recently rejected at a forum last night.
It was Wednesday, the Democratic Central Committee. I was addressing them on some thoughts about the Democratic Party and asking them for their endorsement.
Keep up and join another party?
Well, not in so many words, but the result reflected their complete rejection of my positions.
What was your position? Well, in order for us to know what position we might accept, it was useful to know what they rejected.
I basically just told them that it was important to me as a Democrat to support equal protection under the law, particularly when it applies to same-sex marriage, to support women's right to choice, absolutely.
Both of them deeply imperiled in Santa Cruz.
Yes, and it just didn't resonate with them, but they're very, for Democrats, they're a very conservative group. They nominated or endorsed Cynthia Matthews Don Lane and Rochelle Narayan, and you know who was the fourth most vote-getter that was not endorsed?
Pamela Stock. Democrats are following in the well-worn paw prints of the Republican Party.
Unfortunately so.
And what Steve was saying, as I understand it, is that he tried to bring to the Democratic Central Committee as he tried to get their endorsement for city council that he did believe in equal protection of the laws for women seeking a right to choose an abortion, for gays seeking the right to marriage, and for homeless people seeking the right to sleep and not anywhere and everywhere but somewhere. And they rejected that and endorsed candidates who favor either the opposite or pretending the issue doesn't exist or isn't important or can't be dealt with because it's not politically viable. Plus, there's a large undercurrent of support for a really anti-homeless candidate, although I haven't spoken with her, and I probably should be a little more circumspect based upon the fact that she co-founded or was closely involved with Take Back Santa Cruz. I'm assuming that her positions are not particularly supportive of the civil rights of homeless people. She got the fourth large number of votes at the Democratic Party's little shindig, Central Committee shindig on Wednesday. I think what I'm going to try to do is get a hold of Steve Place and get a report on that and other stuff that's going on. Let's see if he can be reached. He's often working with the needle exchange or suicide prevention. But perhaps we can find him and give him a ring-a-ding and see what we got here. For all the rest of you, phone lines are open, 427-3772, even as we call out on the other line. We may be getting his answering machine, but he may call back. He's got a couple hours before the show ends. We have a couple hours, I should say. And it looks like we have
automatic voice message system.
Have a sort of a no-go.
Is not available. At the tone,
so we will leave him a message, and maybe he will get
when
back to us.
When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hey, Steve, Free Radio listeners may want to know your positions on various issues, or perhaps more important, what others, the power brokers in town who are endorsing and not endorsing council candidates, are actually thinking, and what your experience has been in the last week. So, in other words, updates. We want updates. 427-3772, call us. It's you got 2 hours. It's 11:15. Call us. And for those who want to talk to Steve Place, he's all around the town. You can also call him. I believe he still says he's working on the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project. I'm not sure how much of that has been taken over by his political campaign, but I think he still makes at least token efforts to proceed on that sort of that front. And the number is 466-6078 for those of you who want to get in touch with Steve. 466-6078. Maybe he'll get in touch with us, and maybe you'll get in touch with us. 427-3772. Let's get back to the Friday rally.
The Democratic Women's Club tomorrow morning, and we'll see what they have to say.
And what? That's another election forum?
Yeah, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock at the police community room. That's the Democratic Women's Club of Santa Cruz County.
And you expect that they will see... Has anybody endorsed you other than... I'm not even sure if Huff has endorsed you, but we like you.
Chris Krohn, Celia Scott, Jane Weed Pomerant,
Gail Page.
Gail Page, Paul Ellerick, Tim Fitzmaurice, your great and good friend. We've got some folks behind us.
Group of pseudo progressives out of
course,
power.
Occupy Dana Settler, who I understand maybe
the only decent name in the group, except for Gales, of course.
I think I'm endorsed by Spartacus, but I'll have to find out.
Spartacus. Spartacus. You are Spartacus. Hence, you would be endorsed by Spartacus. That was Steve Place.
And for those who want to actually run into Steve, in case you're interested, you can also find him at the Occupy Santa Cruz General Assembly. He generally shows up before shaking his head in disgust and despair and rushing off to another meeting. But he does participate quite regularly in those assemblies. You can find him there today at 2 o'clock at the post office where the Occupy folks do get together. It's also a critical letter about Occupy in today's Sunday Sentinel from none other than that frequent phone caller, Bob LaMonica. Bob often calls Thomas Levitt's wake-up show, which is right before mine, when it's on. And Thomas told me he was coming to do his show, or at least he hasn't abandoned his show, but nobody has seen him in the studio for some weeks. So I hope he does return to the air, because it's... Yeah, yeah. I don't listen to his show much, frankly, because I'm too busy rushing around preparing for my show, and I'm not usually in the area where my radio picks him up, and I got all kinds of excuses. But he does do a show in the morning, 7:30 to 9:30, or was before my show, and it is actually archived. If you want to hear some of his past shows, they're on the Huff website. They're the first 2 hours of a long tape that covers, I shouldn't say tape, audio file that covers the Thursday and Sunday shows that you can find archived for many years back, at least 4 or 5, and even now 6 or 7 years back, for those who like to probe the historical debris. There's also some meals coming up today for those who are hungry. I believe one is happening at Pastor Steve's church out at the Arrett Circles. That's on the west side of the church. And that started at 11, but I think it goes longer for a couple hours for those who are hungry. He was the pastor, I believe, who we may actually hear him speak next at the rally on Friday. He came. I wasn't terribly happy with his urging everybody to be very conservative and not destroy any property or break any windows, because those kinds of admonitions, I think, aren't really necessary and also tend to chill people and make people feel they're in some sort of a well-regulated cakewalk kind of thing. But he has a good heart. He was the only pastor who made it there that I know of, at least the only one with a collar on that I saw. And I want to thank him for coming and thank other people for coming, too.
More later. Well, this is Steve Schneer. You're joining this ragamuffin band with a candle. Haven't you got something better to do, Steve, and hang out with this kind of crowd?
No, Robert.
A very brief and pungent response. Now, you recently got a write-up in one of the local weeklies about bicycle shenanigans by the police department and the city council. Any new developments on that issue?
I was not at all pleased with the little article in the weekly. But
what didn't you like about that article?
You basically gave Hillary Bryan a chance to speak in a positive way about a program and didn't question it or look for any other investigative facts. I started the reporter off with a lot of documents. He didn't really follow through on any of them. He misquoted, or he took a paraphrase of something that I said I had heard someone else. It was like a third-hand thing I had heard Rick Martinez say that I told him off the record in answer to a question he had, and I told him it was off the record and that it was not a direct thing that I had heard, and he printed that anyway as a quote. So, yeah.
But a man of journalistic integrity of the highest sort. Yeah.
It's irrelevant, really, that to the issue where you're asking what's going on. So, yes, a lot of people are angry about it. We did have to realize that some of our choice of wording was not appropriate. It's kind of stating things in a little bit stronger than we should have for the amount of documents that we had. It's like we have strong suspicion of, but but that we should.
And again, the issue is that the bike church is being essentially fielded out of the bike donations from the Santa Cruz Police Department for political reasons, kind of behind the scenes with no public process.
Yeah, that was a long-standing program that the bike church had collaborated with for the last 4 years of the program, and having gone on for many years, that bikes that the police ended up with would go to youth through nonprofit agencies, and it kind of suddenly stopped without anybody telling us about it or any other group, and now the bikes are going to a for-profit business who has a
bike dojo.
Bike dojo has a youth program, which
bike dodos, as some call them.
There's no evidence I could find that their youth program is a nonprofit or it's sponsored by a nonprofit, and their owner is friends with and or doing business with the husband of Hillary Bryan, and so, and it is true,
could be a conflict of interest.
Yeah, and there was one thing we had to clarify, was that I have never thought that Hillary Bryan or her husband was making money from this. There's not much money to be made in used bikes anyway, but our problem was the possibility
sterling
decisions being made that benefit of somebody's friend and not based on, there's a lot of groups in town that could do this and who would do the best job, and that was always our concern. So at this point, after being basically ignored by the city for months, and Don Lane had said he was going to look into it from mid-June, and I've been trying to get in contact with the assistant city manager, and granted, you know, they say, oh, we're busy and the Warriors and this thing and that thing, and
we actually have covered this in the previous interview. In the last few days, has anything new happened?
So my point was that all these people who didn't have time to talk about it, now they're suddenly, you know, they're talking about it. And
they're talking up a storm. Yeah. They're babbling like chickens.
Well, you know.
Squawking away, perhaps.
We'll see what happens. It appears that, you know, I'd rather not have to go through such great lengths, but it seems like people are willing to talk about it now and maybe find a way to change the program in line more with what most people in the city seem to want.
Power never conceded anything without a demand. And I'm afraid it sometimes takes a while for people to realize that the nice guys, not only to finish last, they get buried before they finish.
Well, certainly some people in the city have tried to turn it around and start calling me a liar and telling me that I'm being ridiculous. But that's what happens, I guess, when you challenge people.
Never happened to me, I'll tell you. Yeah. We've been talking with
Steve Schnarr.
Thanks, Steve. And I can give people more information of a correct sort rather than a schmoozy, bluesy sort.
Well, we have an article that's posted on Indie Media, and we have one that was on the Bike Church website we recently edited, and we'll be up soon again within a day or two.
Bike Church website is?
Oh, it's bikechurch.santacruzhub.org. If you go, or just go to santacruzhub.org, and we're one of the projects, you can link from there.
Thank you, Steve.
And in today's Sentinel, of course, what he's talking about is, you probably gathered, or perhaps you didn't, I've taken interviews from Steve before. He's works with People Power and the Bike Church, and apparently City Council conservatives have able to shift the Santa Cruz Police Department's bike donation program from the Bike Church, which has been the case for the last, since 2006, I believe, to the Bike Dojo, which is a for-profit group that is apparently involved with a relative or a spouse of one of the city council members, or connected in some way to that. So it seemed there may be a financial impropriety there, or at least the appearance of impropriety. But more important, the idea that here, what's really going on here, maybe what's really going on here, I note... here's a letter to the Sentinel today talking about the issue, which reads, I'm upset to hear that a long-standing program to distribute unclaimed bicycles to youth in need has been ended without a public process. Many cities auction their unclaimed bicycles, but in 1996, the city of Santa Cruz decided the community would benefit more by working with nonprofits to get those bicycles to youth in need. Since the Bike Church took over much of the administration and distribution of the program in 2008,415 bikes have been given to local youth in need through organizations like Barrios Unidos, Greenways to School, and the Walnut Avenue Women's Center. Not only was the Bike Church very successful in the distribution of bikes, but youth were also connected to a valuable resource that would teach them how to repair and maintain their new bikes. Now the bikes are being diverted to the Bike Dojo, a for-profit business. The city of Santa Cruz needs to reinstate the former bicycle distribution program and stop diverting bicycles to the Bike Dojo. El Yasmin Mabruk writes this. And in response to that, there is, I believe, a comment at the end of the, in the often toxic comment section. And let's see if we can find that comment. I was reading it earlier. Let's see here. A lot about Obama, peace prizes, drones. Oh, dear. I hope the letter is still here. It was a letter that was actually critical of the Bike Church. Here we go. The Bike Dojo is a terrific company and is owned by great role models for our biking community. Bike Dojo is the for-profit group that the Bikes Santa Cruz Police Department decided without public process through apparently the intervention of Hillary Bryant, Vice Mayor, and others, who will not reveal her emails about this, so we can't really get information. Though I did send her an invitation to come to the rally, by the way, the homeless rally, and also invited her to respond to a question about her emails and to set an appointment, but she hasn't gotten back to me. Of course, it's the weekend. We'll see how she responds. Again, this writer is Angelica Beresford. She writes, "The Bike Dojo is a terrific company and is owned by great role models for our biking community. The Bike Church is run by anarchists and attracts hoodlums who disregard laws and destroy public and private property." And there we go. That's the latest from the Santa Cruz Urinals Toxic Topic stream. There is an article by a letter by Bob LaMonica. "Occupy is a dead brand. What should have been the movement's mandate? Handed to Americans in a platter by Robert Reich, Daniel Ellsberg, David Crosby, and many other luminaries early on is redistribution of wealth, and we, the 99%, agree, tax the rich heavily, like the Scandinavians have done for decades with great success. Failing that, it was inevitable cowards in masks, bandanas, and pseudonyms would predominate, turning an opportunity into a farce only buffoonery supports. Locally, they champion the Occupy Everything 75 River Street bank heist as a noble cause, while its real organizers hide. I was an early supporter when Occupy Santa Cruz had hopeful indications. Consensus killed it. Consensus is a popular and deceptive groupthink procedure which falsely claims participatory decision-making inclusion for all. It is adopted by organizers to disguise actual control and deny effective leadership and direction from emerging." Yeah, of course, I disagree with Bob, who has been on the show quite frequently. Well, not occasionally on my show. He used to call in before we come to our disagreements. He becomes very angry with me. I'm not so angry with Bob, because I realize he's passionate in his point of view and let's just say he's passionate in his point of view. There are some people, including Daniel Wu of the Santa Cruz Patch, who I had on as my guest, one of the potential witnesses in the Santa Cruz 11 case, who was inside the evil, forbidden bank building back in November last year. As a reporter, as I was, who didn't get indicted, who didn't get arrested, who isn't having to essentially go to court hearing after court hearing with 7 years jail hanging over their heads, as the rest of us are. And it's... he, too, had this view that anybody who wore masks was sort of violating the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King and so forth, and I don't know, Desmond Tutu, and Henry David Thoreau. It's hard to say. I don't want to misquote or overly exaggerate. You know, there is certainly a procedure that involves civil disobedience, going to jail to violate an unjust law. Mahatma Gandhi, Satyagraha, the soul force that comes from having your opponent seeing you suffering unjustly and having it eventually spark something deep in that person themselves to realize that they can't do that anymore. It's just wrong. And I have a lot of respect for that. It's very moving. But it's particularly moving to middle-class people like myself who haven't had a lot of direct experience with violence, who aren't facing violent conditions every day simply to survive, because those kinds of conditions often provoke, and I think naturally and understandably, a violent response, which is sometimes helpful and sometimes not. But one thing is clear, that a violent response is better than no response, in the sense that even, at least, I don't want to go back to doing the Holy Writ thing, but I will anyway. Gandhi reportedly also said that, you know, he thought nonviolence was the way to go, but if you have to, resistance was more important than not resisting. If your only way of resisting is violence, then that's what you have to do. Better than not resisting. And then there are some Christians who don't believe in that either. They believe in non-resistance to evil and that sort of thing, because that itself is a greater good. A lot of points of view on this. The idea of masks It's traditional in a number of countries for demonstrators to wear masks because they don't want to be prosecuted by authorities for being in a protest. And in a way, it's ironic that some people, like Daniel and like Bob here, will believe that... we'll use the example of the 75 River Street protests, because the only people that were prosecuted were those who weren't wearing masks, and that was selectively done based on, how the police regarded us, and also what our positions were in the community. Council members like Byers didn't get prosecuted, though she was clearly in the building and even admitted it. And so... it's really an object lesson for exactly the opposite, that if you want to avoid prosecution, you better wear a mask, you know, preferably a whole body suit so they don't know who you are, because the First Amendment protections in society are getting so weak that police will assemble files on you, and they will, even though you think you're just fine, 2 months later they'll come to your house and drag you away in handcuffs, as they did Becky Johnson. In February. Admittedly, I want to say full disclosures, Bob LaMonica was very concerned about that and has expressed a lot of outrage about the prosecutions of the Santa Cruz 11. But you don't hear any, you don't see any of that in this story here. That's unfortunate. People get very passionate. They get very concerned when they're not being, particularly Bob, when he's not being given enough time on the air. You know, he could always run to do his own show. You know, it's possible. I invite people to try to get a show on free radio. It's not hard to do unless, as I said, you really have a heavily right-wing perspective. And I don't think Bob has that. I mean, he certainly is cantankerous, cranky, and has his own perspective and can tell it to you very candidly at different points. So that's one of the letters that's in today's Sunday Sentinel. And I believe there's a couple of interesting letters. There's another issue I was following, and I did do some interviews about a month and a half ago from Aptos, the Safeway takeover of it's more than half of the shopping center out there, the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. And I think there's something in today's Sentinel called Safeway is clearly not listening. And if the computer will listen to me, I can perhaps maybe comment on that. Maybe it's already here, and I'm just... Nope, it's coming up now. We're good. By the way, I know all you're eager to call in and haven't been... you've been waiting perhaps for an opportunity. Now could be your chance. 427-3772. Here's a story by Jim Hall. Safeway is clearly not listening. And Jim Hall is described as an Aptos resident for 35 years. And this was posted in today's Sentinel. It's an opinion piece. On April 1st, on the Sentinel opinion page, I asked whether Safeway would listen to the people's ideas about the planned Rancho Del Mar Center expansion. After several public meetings, the answer clearly is no. And I think you could have gathered that by going to the first meeting, which I just happened to stumble into when I was out there, as I said, a month and a half ago. There are three major objections to the expansion. First, the size of the increase is undesirable. We don't want or need a megastore. Second, many people are upset that many tenants will lose their businesses. Third, the likely traffic congestion on Soquel Drive, both during and after the expansion, has not been addressed. Ironically, the Safeway gas station is the cause of traffic congestion at the upper end of the center, and yet Safeway is planning to increase its size as well. At the meetings, whenever the audience tried to raise any of these objections, Deidre Hamilton announced that the purpose of the meeting was to examine the design, and when the audience's frustration and, yes, anger became evident, she condescendingly told the audience that its anger was inappropriate. The architects have responded to the size issue by proposing designs that would hide part of the building, not change the proposed size increases, and by talking about color schemes. Hamilton stated the plans to displace the tenants have not been changed. All that Safeway has done is provide a $50,000 grant, small change for Safeway, to Cabrillo College. Safeway has raised an appropriate concern regarding access for persons with disabilities. But is the only solution one that disrupts the center and eliminates local tenants? Or is this solution preferred because it justifies the creation of a megastore and a mega gas station? Safeway is not listening despite several meetings open to the public. Who will listen? What can we do? I propose that we attend the appropriate meeting of the Planning Commission. Maybe local officials will listen to our concerns. Jim Hall has been an Aptos resident for 35 years. And certainly that's not a bad idea, but you probably need to amass a lot of power. And, you know, I always suggest potentially preparing nonviolent civil disobedience against these large corporations and amassing a lot of community opposition. You can do things like boycotts, as well as, you know, begging and pleading with your legislators who are oftentimes lobbied rather heavily and rather lucratively by corporations like Safeway. Let's get musical, and I'll be back. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Freak Radio, if you will. That was Loud Man. So there. Back to Friday's protests and some of the coverage from yours truly on tape recorder that was still working at that point.
So as twilight deepens, we have 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55. Yes.
We're not going to leave anything behind here.
Brand is speaking.
We are going to carry, we have three tents.
We actually had, I would say, 70 or 80 people there before the march started, and 50 or 60 on the march, maybe, 30 or 40 at least.
And some signs, and if, so if you have anything left out, let's maybe try to stow that so we're not leaving stuff behind. We'll be coming back here at about 9 o'clock.
Thank you, Brent.
Okay, one thing quickly, everyone has a perfect right to do whatever they want to, of course, but we did have an agreement
over three meetings planning this, that we're not going to use it as a staging ground to fight the cops or break windows. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but let's, this is intended to be kind of a kind first start to a larger campaign, a coalition that we're building, and to have mass appeal, kind of a soft start. We might have lots of different ideas about how to deal with this problem, but this one's just more inclusive tonight. So let's be kind to each other, and I'm not trying to, again, tell you how to behave, but that's what we'd like to see.
And a couple of comments here. I didn't hear anybody even vaguely suggest there should be something like breaking windows or fighting with cops. Although Brent may have interpreted my commentary to police officers about being in the road as fighting with cops, I regard it simply as asserting basic rights and doing so in a way that's helpful to people to encourage them to do so at other times, not just at those relatively rare moments where people come together for symbolic protests and gain some strength and courage from each other, as well as in this particular situation, a sense of legitimacy because the leader of the protest has an agreement with the police, or at least that was sort of the implication I got from Brent, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but I'm always wary of those kinds of agreements. There's also a tendency in leadership, and I'm familiar with this whole problem myself because I've often been a leader in these protests in the past and different points in the past, and one wants to make sure that people, behave, that one, that the police don't have a pretext for breaking things up unnecessarily, that the public doesn't see things in a bad light. All these, of course, are considerations. There are also other considerations that one doesn't try to control things too tightly, particularly if one is a part of a sort of presenting a consensus strategy. So, for example, this protest was originally going to have some consensus discussions, for instance, about how what we would do next and where would we stay the night, would we go any further. No such things ever happened, perhaps because of time constraints, perhaps for other reasons I'm not aware of. There is also some exaggerations made as we listen to the leadership talking about the parade, how we all agreed that different things would be. People actually didn't have those agreements that I was aware of. I think that Brent had a vision of what he wanted, and it's a very strong vision, and in some ways it's very important to have a strong vision because I've got to say, as I said at the beginning of this broadcast, beautiful flyers, a great energy by Brent getting out this whole protest. The problem becomes if he talks about it being inclusive, and I think the tendency is to also be perhaps too concerned with including conservative types, politicians, and appealing to that mentality. I am always very, very wary of that because I've seen that kind of strategy fail so many times and result in co-option. And there's other problems, too. I understand that you can get lefty firebrands and, they do what they do. So I'm kind of expressing my own. These are difficulties that people who lead protests have. I don't think there would have been a protest of this kind without Brent's participation and work. On the other hand, it becomes difficult. Brent was very closely monitoring the protest. When I arrived with signs, he wanted to dictate the signs I should carry, or at least the signs he didn't want me to carry. I think one of them had to do with journalism is not a crime, having to do with the political repression in Santa Cruz around the Santa Cruz 11. I wasn't terribly attached to it, but I wanted the people to decide what they wanted to do because that was my understanding. But the leadership, and I've had this problem myself, I kind of want to, substitute my views for the views of a group. And it's really a temptation because if you're putting in all the energy and you're putting in all the effort or much of it, and you really have a clear vision about what you want, it's really hard not to try to dictate everything, or more than perhaps is wise. And I'm kind of trying to put this rather gently. I'm not saying anything I wouldn't say to Brent directly, and I'll probably see him in a couple hours at the Occupy Santa Cruz. It's a hard thing for organizing these kinds of protests. And sometimes you have real divisions of opinion that are really intractable. Some people believe in a certain approach and making sure that it's not violated. So, for instance, you see this a lot in established Democratic Party institutions, like when a week ago, though some of us went to the Santa Cruz Democratic Labor Day picnic, I guess it was Monday, we brought banners. One of them was the Santa Cruz 11 banner of a group of people who are being charged with the takeover of a bank and a vacant bank building for 3 days peaceful occupation and now face 7 years in jail for that. I didn't assume there'd be any problem. When I got there toward the end of the Democratic Party event, and as I mentioned earlier, we tried to unveil the banner and walk through. And we were blocked by Glenn Schaller, a Democratic Party kind of official, said, "You can't do this. You don't have permission to do this." And I said, essentially, I said, "Bite me. You know, I mean, we're going to do it anyway. It's First Amendment right." We ended up doing it, although he was ranting and raving at us. And we walked through. It wasn't a big deal. We weaved up and down the aisles a couple times, and then we put the banner down and continued with socializing with the people at the Democratic Party Labor Day picnic. And the problem is that I was surprised to find sort of a similar attitude when I came to the protest on Friday. And I think, unlike, I don't want to put Brent on the same level as Glenn Schaller, because I think there's a really considerable difference. I think Brent is miles ahead of Glenn Schaller. There's no question about it. But it's a real temptation when one is either in a position of power or trying to assume a position of power to recognize that really there is a broader process we're trying to support. And that, if you want real inclusion, that can be difficult. You know, it can. I know Occupy Santa Cruz had a lot of problems with people who were drunk and who had alcohol problems, had violence problems. It had to be worked out. It couldn't be dictated. A lot of people wanted to dictate it. Just dictating did not work. And so, I don't know. It's been a real concern for me the last few days as I've reflected on it. I felt a lot of resentment at the time, and some of it I'm sure comes through in this broadcast. But I'm not trying to pretty it up or paper it over here, because I also do not think there would have been a protest if we hadn't had the incredible energy and persistence of Brent Adams. And again, hats off to him for doing that. Let's hear some more from the protest.
Pastor Steve from the Circle Church is going to come up and say a few words to lead us out.
Can you hold this for me? I got text stuff. Can you hold this for me? Just hold it right now.
If you want to hold it for you, or you can hold it.
I guess I can hold it. Well, first, thanks for inviting me. It's an honor to speak to you and to many of you who have done so much more in terms of personal sacrifice for this issue.
There you go.
I want to talk to you a little bit from the perspective of about all the spiritual traditions that exist in the world. They all kind of recognize the power of intention, that we create reality by our intentions. And if we want to create a positive reality, then the intentions need to be clear. But there's incredible power when people unite around a clear and focused intention. The reality literally changes already when we do that. So I want to encourage you to just take a moment to think about our intentions as we begin this. As I understand the intention of this action, it is to stand for the dignity of all people, whether you live inside or outside.
Yeah.
It's to stand for respect for all human beings, to be human beings, wherever you live or whatever your circumstances. It's to stand for compassion for everyone, including those who live outside. And if that's what we want to see happen in the world, our intention needs to be there, and then we need to reflect that in our actions by doing this action together with a clear intention to be respectful and compassionate and respect the dignity of everybody, including those who maybe really are clueless. In a moment, I'm just going to give you a moment of silence to think about your own intentions. And before I do, I want to mention Gandhi once said that anger and intolerance make it impossible to have correct thinking. And I would add to that fear. I've noticed that almost everyone I talk to lately is operating from an energy of fear. That's not an intention that's going to create a constructive world.
Thich Nhat Hanh said that to make peace, you need to be peace. And so if we want to make peace, we need to be peaceful people as we go about this tonight, even as we stand firmly convicted about the respect and dignity and rights of all people, including those who live outside. So I want to invite you to first take a moment to reflect on your own intentions and honor the outrage, the anger, the frustration that we all feel about what's happening to the most vulnerable people in our communities. Take a moment to honor that. It's there and it's real. That energy is not evil. Just take a moment to center your intentions, to use that energy to construct a better world, to believe, to stand for that we can be better people than what we're being in this city right now. And so with having cleared that away, I want to invite you to just take a moment, find that place in your heart where you really believe in people. That's why you're here. And then when we're told to, let's step out and march with that intention.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And actually, that speech is better than I heard it critically described by at least another one or two other participants, a sort of a kumbaya kind of speech in a sort of negative way. I think anger is really an important motivating force. You don't just honor the anger. You realize the anger is an activating force here. And the fear is also an activating force. The idea that we should all be Gandhi before we stand up and engage in any political protest is, to me, unworkable, unfair, and in a way, I mean, it's counterproductive when you have that. I mean, it's sort of equivalent to the philosophy of the 70s, which is, you know, the me generation. Well, work on yourself first and the world will change. Sure, the world will change if you work on yourself, but there are also things happening in the world that need to be addressed that don't really involve you working on yourself at all. And the anger you feel when injustice is happening to you or other people is a really legitimate and appropriate response. And I think Pastor Steve recognizes this to some extent. But this focus on, it's sort of a, and he is a pastor, you know, he's not directly a political activist here. I tend to be really clear that certain political institutions and people got to be held accountable for this kind of stuff. And it's quite appropriate to feel real anger at them. I mean, I remember a speech up at Occupy Oakland, the second round of going after the ports, where a woman was speaking and saying that hatred is a good thing if you hate certain institutions and the way certain leaders are acting. I think she even went so far as to say the leaders themselves. I tend to back off from that point because I guess maybe it's middle classness, maybe it's some sort of religious aspect I have in myself, I don't know. But I think it's also true that talking about respect for the rights of all, including the homeless people, is really kind of, how would you put it? It misses the point. This is not about the rights and dignity of all people. This is about the rights of an abused group that is facing destruction of their property in a way that no people in houses would ever tolerate. They'd start shooting. I mean, if they had a gun, they'd come out. If they saw this happening regularly, there'd be civil war. And in a way, it is a form of civil war. It is a form of class war against people who cannot fight back. And it's important, I think, for people to mobilize to realize they can fight back, hopefully in ways that are effective for me because I'm so nervous about violence, ways that are nonviolent. But certainly to fight back. And that's why I'm a little wary of this kind of, let's all have a really broad coalition. And, you know, I mean, a broad coalition is important. But I think you get it by emphasizing the truths of what's going on, not continually reiterating that everybody has to be very, very peaceful and follow their leaders. In this case, it was Brent. You know, in the next case, it might be me or somebody else. You know, I think a new process was evolved at Occupy Santa Cruz, unwieldy in many ways. People say, where's your program? Where's your program? And I like programs, some kinds of programs. I like agendas. I like demands on particular things, but I also recognize that people have been divided so often, and that's how those in power keep us down, that if we can find the things that unite us, we don't need to emphasize the divisions. We need to emphasize what we share together. And that's hard to do, but it's also, in a way, rather obvious. Everybody's being fucked over, pretty much by rising prices, by a war economy that is obviously unnecessary, by increased nonsense about terrorism, huge police expenditures. I know there's differences of opinion. There's some people feel it's absolutely necessary. There are terrorists on every around every corner, in the sense that we've got to, 9/11. But I don't think the majority of people do believe that. Or if they do believe it, I think they're being misled by phony propaganda around that issue. Anyway, I think the march began soon after this last speaker. Let's hear some more.
Hi, it's me again.
Hey, Brent.
So we're going to go the route. We're going to visit the parks office over here very quickly. And I think maybe Becky Johnson will have a few words to say about what's happening with why we're visiting the parks office. Then we're actually going to make a beeline straight down Church Street here to Cedar. Then we're going to hang a left on Cathcart. We kind of, at that point, we can stick, if it looks good, we can take the road. We're, at that point, we're not really challenging traffic. Let's stay on our lane. We're going all the way to the river levee first to talk about what's happening out at the river levee. We're going to do a loop around the 418 and go back down the parking, up Front Street to Cathcart, and then we're going to slowly, very slowly, walk up Pacific Avenue and have kind of a party in front of O'Neill's open space there. Tent Bob, and after that we're going to come back here for a little bit of a rally and some music. Okay? I found myself almost talking like Pastor Steve there.
Ages.
Great minds think alike.
What? Repeat what?
The itinerary you just described, so we have a picture we can hang on to.
Okay, quickly again. We're leaving here in about 5 minutes after we gather our things. East down Church to Cedar, south down Cedar to Cathcart. We're going to hang a left. We're going to make a beeline to the river levee. We're going to the parking lot there and up the ramp. Going to head south down the river levee. Stay there and have some words about what has occurred to the river levee in the last few months, to the homeless people, and how now none of us can appreciate it. I'll be quick. Then we're going to go up Front Street to Cathcart and to Pacific Avenue North. Then we're going to hang out and do a little tent mob flash camping and interact with people there at O'Neill's. And then we're going to come back up Lincoln or Church and back to here. Is everybody? Yeah, here. Good?
Thank you.
I'd like to open up the space for 2 minutes if anybody else would like to say anything.
I would like to say something.
Okay.
Linda. This is Linda LeMaster, who goes to court on October 15th under the lodging law for a prior protest like this, although one that stayed overnight and actually established a real sleeping space for homeless people, not simply a symbolic here and gone. And people had to pay for it. Linda is facing trial. Ed Fry is under house arrest, and Gary Johnson is in jail. Again, you would thought that there might be some violence, some destruction, vandalism, broken. No, there's just sleeping and actually providing toilet facilities for homeless people with a porta potty.
It's a trigger. But it might just turn off at any point.
I'm going to have to just use my real voice. As bad as my voice is, these machines are harder. Okay. Is this working?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't going to say this loudly, but in the wake of the wonderful prayer, I'm going to just try anyway. One of my fears, which makes me angry, which I'm going to be releasing, thanks to the love that's here, is how I feel about the police department not only doing what they're doing to human beings and giving up their own humanity, but totally reversing established protocol, a mission that the city has declared itself it wants to adhere to, and any kind of line of authority that links it to city, to this city hall, and therefore the people, supposedly. So there's a policy issue that kicks me in the gut, and I think we need to at least put it back before another week goes by.
That's right.
We're already over time. You're gonna have some more later.
Yeah, I will be talking later for people. Brent assures me. I just wanted to say that. City Council meeting on Tuesday has a $250,000 appropriation for private security guards around town. That's coming up on the agenda. Linda, who just spoke, is going to court on October 15th, facing 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine for the crime, essentially of supporting Peace Camp 2010, sitting next to someone who was ill late at night on the steps of the county building. And Linda's also written an excellent article, which is on the Street Spirit website. I encourage people to look at it. And maybe we'll have more to say when this is over. Thank you, Brent.
So here we are moving down Church Street. It's about 8:20. Becky gave a stirring speech at Parks and Rec, which I didn't catch on tape. But perhaps Al Nunes has a summary of what she said.
No, I'm not up for it. Sorry, Robert.
Oh, dear. Well, there you are. In any case, Fitter, what was your reaction to Becky's speech? Again, a moment of silence. Perhaps an entire block of silence. You never could tell. Here there are three sort of tent monsters or tents being carried by four people, one at each corner. We have a man who's providing a little tuba music. He actually also provided some t-shirts about the sleeping ban, which read, "Stamp out sleep crime." I got one of those t-shirts and I recommend them. So now we are approaching the levee, and it's kind of hot and sweaty in this bathroom, but Eduardo, the police bear, is hanging in there with me on my belt.
And often, as I do in court and in protest, I was wearing a bathrobe with a teddy bear, and sort of as a mocking sort of protest symbol of how absurd the law against sleeping is for homeless people outside, and a recognition of. So people can smile to some extent at how silly the whole thing is. And indeed, it was kind of hot and sweaty in that. But we continued to plod on through, going up to the levee, and here's probably some speeches that happened up there.
Several NDBA journalists with us, Bradley and Alex. I even saw a Santa Cruz patch photographer nearby.
All right, how are you?
And we are approaching the illegal levee zone after dark. This could be...
Keep going right.
Brandon, of course, is his non-controlling approach. He's advising people what to do.
No trespassing from dusk to dawn. Because of drug deals, they said. That was 10 years ago. It's still off limits to the public.
And Becky is announcing the absurdity of the new laws. Last time I was on a march here at night, it was with Take Back Santa Cruz City for the Prevention of Violence Against Women. And
you're not allowed to sleep outdoors either.
There you are.
And they had permits from the city, of course. We had none. But again, the Constitution does not need a permit.
A little cooler up here. This time it's being done without a permit, which is nice. The tents are being set down here in back of University Cuppy on the levee, and people are circling the levee here. How's it going?
It's going good.
What you're carrying a candle. Identify yourself for our police department.
I'm Bean.
And Bean, what brings you to this particular protest?
I don't believe people should be persecuted for exercising basic human functions like sleeping.
Are you naive or something?
I just like people being well rested who live around me. That's all.
And has that happened to you with your friends recently?
No, but the past probably about 5 or 6 months ago. That's about it.
Thank you, Bean.
It's like the one we're violating right now. And I asked the sheriff, what if lodging is that activity which constitutes lodging, is the same activity people use when peaceably assembled to seek redress of government grievances?
Here, here.
You see, when we have a persistent effort to try to hold the electeds accountable, and we don't just like go home as soon as it is dinner time. They pass laws against us, and they do it without a public process. They do it in violation of their own procedure, and they do it when you're not looking, and they take away the rights of everyone. This particular levy was deemed no trespassing from dusk to dawn because of Mike Rodkin and the Santa Cruz Police Department. They said that there were too many drug deals going on here. That was 10 years ago. Now this space is not available for people to use at night. And it coincidentally is where a lot of homeless people have been driven out and have to seek refuge to sleep illegally here. That's how these guys roll. Take back public places. There are places.
So a lot of you already know about the levy. You spend a lot of time out here. I don't have to tell you. But most recently, the entire 2 miles from here, well beyond the tannery, from the river levee all the way up, there are signs posted. You can check Alex DeRossi's article and photo journal about that. It's actually illegal to be anywhere off the asphalt for the entire 2 mile stretch on both sides. It's illegal to even approach the water in the entire downtown Santa Cruz. And that's, we all lose, but it's mainly against the homeless people who are just trying to find a safe place to sleep. And I'm pretty fed up with it. But so we're here, in a way, just taking it back for now and educating ourselves. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you, Becky.
Anybody else want to say something very quickly?
Can I say something really quick?
Or we get this gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Casey Wright. It's all on the same themes. My name is Casey Wright. I just came back to town about a week ago. I grew up in this town. And I'm not really homeless by choice, but kind of I am now. I'm going after an SSI claim. I have a bad back and some mental instability, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm the worst guy to be around. But anyway, I grew up in this town. I can't afford to live here. I have 6 generations. My mom tells me not to talk about that, but it doesn't matter. I was down there the other day. You know, I was trying to be good and I was trying to get my bag, but I got swarmed upon by 3 cops just for standing there for 3 minutes, and it sucked. And I was recording that, and I think I'm going to publish that. I'm not trying to get mad at the cops, but damn it, don't crowd me. And I really do think that there's major implications for, like, Fourth Amendment, redress of grievances, perpetual and peaceable assembly issues I've been occupying for all year. And I think this is a constitutional issue. We have a right to be on the land. We have a right to dictate to the representatives how we want our government to be. And this is an issue that should unite libertarians and traditional conservatives as well as progressives and anarchists. This is American as apple pie, and we have a right to live in the towns where we were born. And I believe in peaceful ethics, but some people, perhaps not me, but some returning veterans and others who are very, you know, poor and homeless and dealing with some of the same issues I deal with, we are getting angry. And so peace is great, but some of us are being driven nuts. And with that being said, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. Nice.
very quick. We got to get that. We get going.
Okay, I was just going to say really quick, we all know why we're here, and I myself am now homeless, and being a part of the community has really opened my eyes, and I had a conversation the other day with a couple of buddies of mine, and we were talking about the bushhogging of these, the levee, and just how people don't care when they're doing this, don't care about the potential people that were sleeping in those bushes while things were happening, and the people's stuff, their survival gears and things like that, you know. And I feel that that's just one thing, you know, out of many that, you know, the city should know. The city should really recognize, you know, what they're potentially digging up when they're just knocking everything down. And I just thought that should be recognized for a moment.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Really quickly, my name is Tatiana, and I'm I've been homeless now off and on since 2005. I have a 15-year-old, and now I have a 1-year-old. At this time, I'm being brought up on criminal charges for not being able to pay my bills. At this time, my children are being persecuted for being homeless, and basically what's happening is what do they call that when a cop stereotypes?
Profiling.
Exactly. So we're being profiled. Homeless people are being profiled, and criminal charges are being created just for them. In a group of many, if you're known to be homeless, then you will be the one charged with whatever's going on, regardless of if your actions have anything to do with it. So this removal of homeless people, this disruption of their homes on free land, this has so many implications. So many different people are becoming hurt, not just the drug addicts, but yeah, the drug addicts too, because all of us survive off of their discomfort. All of these people have jobs to service these people. All of these peace officers are neglecting the fact that they are to provide peace for everyone, not just those who can afford to pay them. We are all people here, and we all deserve the peace that peace officers are supposed to provide.
Amen. Thank you.
I'm sorry, we can't step it up, mainly because we've got to get back to before we have a 10 o'clock shutoff and we have a rally. Very quick, David. I'm sorry to.
And again, this is Brent. Again, the difficulty of a leader who has a sort of a schedule he's trying to keep to, and of course, not aware the schedule was really consented to by anybody else in this group, but, you know, it's still not bad. I mean, we're all doing something important. And I want to also give Brand a credit for what he was doing here is, though he is, you know, constantly saying, we have to get going, he is also allowing people to speak anyway. And that's really important, because what is being said here is, and the people who are listening to what is being said, I think, is the core of this protest.
I just say I'm a veteran, but I also consider Santa Cruz my home. I had to go, you know, take care of my mom with her Alzheimer's, and then my ex. So I was gone for 8 years, but I told that everything was here. 3 days before I came back, the city council defunded all housing for AIDS. Okay, so all the AIDS patients last summer were thrown out in the street, and I was one of them, and it was really hard. But veterans saved me. Wasn't for veterans, I wouldn't have made it. And the levee is where you could meet and find out where it's safe. This was like a community center for me. This levee saved my life more than once. I could find out what was going on here. This as a homeless person, you have to have this levee to survive. Thank you.
One other thing, really short. If you're a veteran and you're without housing, say something to me afterwards.
Yeah, sign up.
Okay? Because there's housing available for all veterans.
You don't want veterans to pay any more than 30% of their income. That's the most they pay for rent from now on if you sign up.
It's automatic, Section 8.
Tense up.
Yeah. And away we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
And after those speeches, it's about 10 to 9, and we're moving back off the levee. Thank you for waiting for us. And we have our man on the tuba who continues to regale us with some deep notes. What's your name, tuba man?
Anthony.
Thank you, Anthony. And we're back on Cathcart Street, heading for Pacific Avenue. Still a few candles lit, although I imagine they're burning low. The little Dixie cups people have been carrying as part of the candlelight vigil. There's the smell of tallow wax, cool air of late summer that's still got the warm taste of the summer. Enough to make me take off my heavy bathrobe. And we're at SoCal and Pacific. I'll try to get out of the way of the trombone, or tuba, I should say. There's a large, sort of a group of bandy people who are here dancing to wait for us, dancing in glittery clothing. And it looks like about 20, 40, 60, 110 or 20 people here, half on the sidewalk in front of the Forever 21 show, or a small number actually on the sidewalk, a larger number in the intersection. And the traffic is blocking up. Someone should direct the traffic.
And for those who remember, this is a sort of a very small repeat of what happened on the last few New Year's Eves, when there would be a last night New Year's parade, unpermitted, and recently unharassed for the last 2 years. But the parade would stop usually around Cinema 9, and there would be a... In earlier years, when the parade first started in 2005, 2006, and that turning of the year, I think there was a pillow fight, and there was all kinds of an hour or two long stop there, blocking the street. And gradually, the time has diminished, gotten shorter and shorter, and I guess people become more and more nervous about police. There's never been any violence at the New Year's parade that I'm aware of, that I remember. And this was a sort of a people's parade created by the community, initially announced by Wes Modes way back 2005-2006. And that was, of course, a famous police scandal when then-Police Chief Vogel, or now-Police Chief Vogel, who was then, a lieutenant or a deputy or some such thing, he assigned intelligence officers to infiltrate at the peaceful planning of this parade in violation of sort of standards that I think community has. May not be technically illegal, but it's a form of political surveillance. And then when it was supposedly investigated, he assigned himself to investigate it. And the mayor thought that was fine. That was Mayor Matthews at the time. City manager, Dick Wilson at the time, thought that was fine. Nobody objected. And near Don Lane objecting, for instance. I think there were a couple of ex-mayors who did object. I think Keith Sugar did object. However, Vogel. Finally, there was a complaint from the independent police auditor, who isn't that independent, but he did, in fact, Bob Aronson is his name, say you can't really investigate yourself, Chief Vogel. That ain't going to work. That doesn't sound too independent. But there were no changes, really significant changes in the rules, and police can continue to do the kind of surveillance they were doing before without any real monitoring or set of better rules such as San Francisco had and the San Francisco ACLU suggested. And the local ACLU hasn't really taken any position on that, as far as I know, and hasn't taken any position on the sleeping ban, and hasn't taken any position on the criminalization of the homeless and the sweeps. And it has taken a limited position on the Santa Cruz 11, thanks to the initiative of Steve Plaich. Other initiatives, however, involving the curfew, eliminating the curfews around these buildings, which are public buildings, and not only it impacts homeless people who need to find some place to curl up and hide and try to sleep in a relative safety of some small groups, That hasn't been taken up by the ACLU either. Plaich is on the board of directors, and I keep telling him to get it together to do that. There's always something else that's more important or something else that's happening. And perhaps I can get a call from him and find out what he's up to. Maybe I'll give him another call and see what's cooking. Again, as with my criticism with some of the leadership of the protests with Brent, it's not... We're talking a mixed bag with a lot of people, as with many find with me. We all have our... Those who will criticize us, those who see, you know, concerns in us, but I think... And I have a lot of generally positive attitudes, or... I'm not too happy with Brent at the moment, but I mean, I think I'm really feeling that I have to assess that the general impact of Brent and Steve has really been positive, and keep up the work is what I say. Let's hear some more of the last of the Friday evening parade, the vigil against violence against the homeless, the violence of the police department, Parks and Rec, City Council, and the thugs in power.
The 310 Monte moves on down the street. The head of the parade is Al Nunez with a flag. And the first mask appears for the masked man. Generally, people have been unmasked in this protest, or maskless. Steve Plaich is holding a corner of the front tent. And
there were actually, as I explained before, three very lightweight tents that I guess in theory you could wear them and walk with them, but these were being kind of hoisted by four people, and they were very light, as I said. Being carried along is a sort of a symbol of these are really what homeless people need to use to survive, maintain their dignity and privacy, store their stuff, the obvious points. And these are what are being destroyed by authorities, falsely claiming that these are somehow instruments of criminality simply because there is a criminal conspiracy against the homeless by those in power who wish to appease some property owners and merchants who prefer to see them all gone.
Stop the sweeps against the homeless! You don't like the bank?
Shit. Hey, the crookedest street is not Lombard Street, it's Wall Street.
And what happened to you?
Hey, they took five projects and four-fifths of my retirement.
And your first name is?
Anonymous.
Thank you, Bill. There was a guy standing by the side whose comment was, fuck the banks.
And that was another thing that Brent didn't want any signs about. And I tend to think that it's often better to have a more inclusive kind of protest where you do have some signs. I mean, Occupy Santa Cruz was inclusive, and it had, you know, really diverse different kinds of folks. And there's some that say, yeah, well, that's why it all fell apart, didn't have an adequate program to draw people. I think it fell apart because of police repression. That's why it fell apart. I mean, there were other problems that it had. It was working with a very, very difficult task of accommodating and including the homeless community, which was working, as far as I could see. A difficult but real and important process. And having diversity is important. So let's have diversity or diverse will happen to us.
And we are at O'Neill's, where people are pausing to...
listen to a singer, as you can hear.
Yeah, I like it.
And Steve Plage is observing a new camper inside a tent downtown on Pacific Avenue on the sidewalk. It's very shocking, actually. It says OSC on the side, Occupy the Commons. And OSC, of course, is code, for those who understand it, for Occupy Santa Cruz. And we have the songs of elderly radicals drifting through the air of the sidewalk. Although it is, Albert, it's being sung by a young guy. And the crowd of people who have been walking with us up and down Pacific Avenue is perhaps a little diminished, but there's still a group of folks here. Not a word.
That's good for
wrote another version of that song called The Times They Are Deranging, but that's for another show, I think.
So, what happened when you appeared before the Democratic Doodah group tonight?
No, this was the Right to Vote on V-Cell Coalition.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're my people.
So you're actually going to get an endorsement in this campaign?
Yes, indeed I am.
Impressive.
Well, that and Huff. So.
Huff has not endorsed you yet, Plage. And if I have anything to say about it,
we can forward to their candidates for them.
It's coming up. Becky Johnson will push that whole thing through.
As long as we get free Becky Johnson is what I say.
She's currently at liberty.
Yeah. It's about...
We're going to be on the Saturday special. Actually, by the time we play this tape, KSCO will have put you on. What are they interviewing you about?
Just all of my BS. I have endless amounts of words. Once I kind of get going and I feel like I have my role going, I tend to kind of expound.
How are you presenting yourself?
I mean, he's interviewing me as somebody he encountered here who doesn't necessarily fit the profile of someone who they would assume they would find here. So when we got talking, he kind of heard about my job and kind of...
What was your job?
Well, my job is as a stage tech, and I have a couple stories that I was telling him, and he kind of was enjoying them.
Also a tuba player, a T-shirt maker, stamp out sleep crimes. Rest is a privilege reserved for those who can afford it. Reads your T-shirt. Why can't those homeless freeloaders figure that out? At last, some words of sense to a senseless community.
It's like, why can't they just figure it out? We need more rich people to come down here and assert their right to not have to see the homeless. You know,
exactly.
I mean, it's really unfair.
You'll be bringing this up on Zwirling's show.
Okay, so yes, it's really unfair how rich millionaires, when they're driving and their windows are tinted, but sometimes they see poor people through the windows, and it's unpleasant.
It's down on business.
They're kind of enjoying the afterglow from the big capital raid on the company they just moved to Singapore, and you just seeing homeless families, it just kind of kills the buzz. And
it's a downer, man. It's a downer, no question about it.
I want to respect the right of millionaires to not have to see poor people. I mean, after all, get real. I mean, take a bath, buy something from the Gap is right there. Hello, the Gap is right there. You can walk in there and buy yourself some brand new...
We will eagerly await your appearance, or perhaps your disappearance, on the KSCO show, which I think will be archived. I think the Saturday special is...
I'm just kidding. I don't know what I'm going to...
It is generally archived. We'll find you. I guess those who want to know better, go to KSCO.org or whatever.
And I haven't done that yet, but I will be checking out the show. This was the tuba player who really provided us with the music. And he also had a great T-shirt about celebrating how evil sleep crime is and how the police really need to crack down and so forth. A satirical T-shirt, of course. And I'll be wearing it every so often along with my 5,000 other T-shirts. So, about a half an hour left in the show. You are listening to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse. We talk about a variety of issues, as you can hear, mostly homeless civil rights stuff. And... I also have a Wednesday meeting that I go to called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We sort of scheme and plan and plot and argue and fight and part of this protest came out of that meeting, as I said, largely in large part due to the enthusiasm of Brent Adams, who has been attending meetings recently, and I also with support from Occupy Santa Cruz and Pastor Steve and candidate Steve and all kinds of Steves and all kinds of folks. And hopefully more protests are going to emerge. But Huff meets every Wednesday at 10 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, where we swig coffee or tea or whatever we want and try to figure out if there's anything we want to do for the next week that might throw some educational, satirical, or, some light on what's going on in Santa Cruz amidst the darkness, because it's a deepening darkness, unfortunately, rather than a rising light. Though it's good to see the bike church folks holding the police department, Vice Mayor Bryant, even Mayor Don Lane. And they should also be talking about Martine Bernal, who is, of course, the true head of the city manager, accountable for, again, cutting off another source of bikes for political reasons, I think. The nasty letter, it was actually a nice letter in the Sentinel, but followed by a nasty comment that I read earlier. You don't want to give bikes to those anarchists. The bike dojo is a respectable business. The bike church is a bunch of anarchists and hoodlums. You know, that's... I think that that kind of mentality just might be behind this police department shift to passing on bikes to a for-profit company rather than a company that's essentially providing both bikes and repair service training for low-income folks and young people. But hopefully Steve Snare and others, maybe Micah Posner, will have something to say about that. Micah was the head of People Power for a long time, a bike rights group. He is now running for the shitty council, as I sometimes call them. He has a kickoff rally today at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on Ocean Street. It's not so new anymore, but still newer than last year location. And it's, again, at 2 o'clock today. If you want to talk to Micah, find out what he is or isn't saying about basic issues, and that's one of the problems with Posner. He doesn't have a lot of clear, strong statements on the issues that are important to me. And I talked to him about, what about the sleeping ban? He goes, we need a regulated campground. I said, well, kind of, sure. But in the meantime, and we have the dancing around stuff. I don't know. I mean, I'm still waiting for his position papers to come out. To me, it's sort of a no-brainer. If you don't oppose the sleeping ban, then you've essentially sold out to people in positions of authority, or you have some sort of, I don't know what, some sort of fundamental blind spot, or maybe you're deeply involved with the Downtown Association and don't want the sleepers. Although I think if you are involved with the Downtown Association, you want to have a legal place for people to go so they wouldn't be sleeping downtown, you know? It's all kind of... it's all a situation.
Find me for it.
We have an evictee from the forest. Your name, sir?
Sounds like we got a caller coming in now, so I'm going to break with the taping and move on to the speaking. Hey there, caller. You're on free radio.
Hey, Robert. How you doing?
This sounds like the much-abused Andrea Morgan.
Yes, it is.
You're the woman who was circulating a petition on the rights of disabled people at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. You were, evicted because of an incident where they claimed you were violent, and you pointed out that you had simply been trying to get into a Sunday meal, and then you were robbed a week or two ago because you had to sleep outside. You're disabled. You have a walker. You have a variety of medical conditions. Tell me if I'm wrong about any of that.
Pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
What's the good word? What's the bad word? What's the report?
Well, after that incident, okay, I got a call from that bitch Tracy Hegum, who's the program manager for River Street on August 8th. And she tells me that, at first, on July 30th, I'm told because of that incident, the day before, that I'm banned from the campus for 7 days. Well, then after John Colby's sister and I went to the police department on the 31st and made a police report, somewhere thereafter it turned into a 30-day ban. So then I get a call from Tracy Hegum on August 8th telling me, well, due to that incident, you're basically banned for 7 days. However, if no other violent incidents has happened, after 30 days, you know, we'll keep your name at the top of the list. And I'm like, okay. So then I call a couple weeks ago, and this woman, Susie's telling me, oh, Tracy's not here, but I can tell you that you're, as far as the River Street Shelter, my ban with them's over September 8th. However, she says you can call on the 6th and check. Sometimes people leave early, but I couldn't call on the 6th because I had something else going on with another friend of mine. I had to help her out. But anyway, I called yesterday because it was the 8th, and I called yesterday evening, and I talked to this woman, Brenda, and she says, oh, well, you're still number one at the top of the list, so just, you know, make sure to call back every 3 days and check in. And I said, oh, okay, well, so then you don't even have any beds available at all, like not even possibly a crisis bed? And, oh, no, sorry, they're all filled up. But then I talked, two girlfriends of mine got in there last Tuesday on the same day, and they both came out last night to bring me a cigarette, and one of them told me, yes, Andrea, there's an empty bed in the hallway. So, you know, and she's like, it just really, you know, disheartens me that I'm walking past an empty bed in the hallway, and you're laying out here on the dirt, you know, sleeping outside. And I was like, oh, well, you know, that's about the way my luck goes. So
now you were,
I have a friend.
I
have a friend who's here at the Metro real quick, and He actually, he's an older man. He's 64 years old, but he was in the cafeteria that morning. He saw what happened. So I'm going to sit with him either this afternoon or tomorrow, get a witness statement from him. I'm going to go to the copy place right here. I'm going to make copies of my side of the security incident report of what happened, get whatever documentation I need to get from John. John said he already faxed some stuff to this lawyer at Legal Aid, and I'm going to go over to Legal Aid on Wednesday afternoon and say, you know, here's my documentation, this is what happened, and see what happens there. And I'm hoping they'll take the case, and if I need some justice here, I really do. I'm really pissed off.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who do. You slept outside on the dirt last night?
Mm-hmm.
Where did
last three nights? Because
the
satellite
place
program still
same place as ever. Don't just say where you slept, but I'm just wondering. You probably were. And you had. So you're saying you had information. They had a bed, but they wouldn't let you into it. That's what.
Yeah, She said that they didn't have any empty beds, but then a friend of mine says, "Oh, there's an empty bed right here in the hallway." So there was an empty bed there last
night. Now you're talking
night,
about.
I guess for me,
River Street. This is the River Street Shelter you're talking about, or?
Yep.
Right, they're actually, for those who don't know, there are two shelters that they're both programs. You have to sign up. If River Street Shelter lets you in for 30 days, and they claim to have some crisis beds, but these are usually reserved for people who come, I think, from psych wards or from the hospital. Right, I don't know what the story is. And the second thing is the Paul Lee Loft. Has it closed down yet, or has, should I say, been filled up with people who are from the Paige Smith?
Supposedly, the Paige Smith house closes down on the 15th, and they're going to boot everybody out of the loft, and they're going to move everybody from Paige Smith into the Poly Loft. So that's supposedly all coming down on the 15th of this month.
So tonight you'll also be sleeping out on the dirt, or are you going to be going to the Red Church?
I don't know yet. If I have the energy to go to my storage and walk all the way back to downtown, I might go to the Red Church and go up to the First Congressional Church on High Street. Or if I don't, then I'll just drag my bedding out by the corner there and I'll just sleep there again. I don't know. I'm really tired today. It's been kind of a long few nights.
And you still haven't contacted police about the robbery that you suffered about a week ago, a week and a half, actually 2 weeks ago now.
No.
And why is that? You just don't want to talk to them? You're afraid it'll be turned around?
I mean, Robert, I made a police report about being assaulted. They've done nothing. None of all this stuff should even happen, you know. John could have made an accommodation request to the mayor and the shitty council to put in place something so that the homeless lack of services center staff, you know, wouldn't retaliate against me, and they've done nothing. So, you know, here I made a police report. Detective took pictures of my documentation, gave me a case number, and I've heard nothing. So going to them about, you know, a bag and, you know, some other stuff that got stolen. Really, I don't see what good it would do to
you. Yeah, I wouldn't assume it does any actual practical good in terms of their response. I just think it's useful to have a document that said, I went to them, I left a report. Case closed. Mm-hmm. That's it. They did nothing. Another example of how I'm being treated, and that I think it's important. I think it's important to do that. I would still encourage you to keep thinking about doing that. Just, you know, I mean, I know it's a pain. I know you're not going to get anything out of it necessarily, but you will have done it. And so,
yeah.
And you can do it online too if you can get maybe John Colby to help you.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Andrea Morgan, who's how long have you been in Santa Cruz, Andrea?
About 25 years.
And how much of the time were you housed?
Until October 8th of 2009.
And what prompted your losing your housing?
Well, I was having a lot of problems with fatigue, and I still don't know actually what the cause and what the problem is. And I was having really bad problems with fatigue, and I had gotten the recertification paperwork from the housing authority, and somehow I managed to slip through my fingers. I remember getting the mail. I remember looking at it, and I guess I kind of set it aside, and I sort of didn't really forget about it. But, you know, I was having so many problems with fatigue that it kind of slipped my mind. And then I found it, and I realized, oh, my God, you know, and I had so many days get it in. And I actually did it and got it over to them, but there was, like, one piece of paper or one thing that I was missing, and I couldn't remember what it was. I remember trying to, what is it that you need from me? You know, what hoop do I have to jump through to get my paper certified? I can't even remember what it was. Whatever it was, I couldn't get it in time. So, I lost the rental assistance part, and a few months before that, my apartment failed the inspection only because the inspector said, well, you have, you know, all your stuff here in all these boxes, you know, is cluttering up your apartment. They can't be here. I mean, I'm not a hoarder. I don't go out and drag stuff in. It was just my stuff. I mean, you do collect stuff when you live in a place for years and years. And there was no biohazard. There was no, you know, no stacked up garbage. There was nothing like that. It was just my stuff. And I could still get around my apartment just fine. There was no fire hazard. But he failed my inspection. So I was scrambling to try to get my place to pass my inspection. I was scrambling to try to find this piece of paper. And so, yeah, so that's what happened. And then all of a sudden, the landlord, you know, took advantage, you know, because I'd been there so many years. He wanted to get me out so he could remodel, boot me out, and move somebody else in and jack up the rent. And that's exactly what he did.
And when did you first notice these physical conditions that essentially gave you disability?
Well, I first started having problems with severe pain, like around 1999. I started noticing that, you know, I'd walk a certain distance and my lower back would start to hurt real bad. And I'd have trouble with some pain in my legs, so I'd have to sit down, rest for a while. And so, you know, so then I started using crutches. Then I went from crutches, back and forth using a cane, and then I moved up to a walker, and yeah, and so it kind of kept progressing, you know, getting worse and worse. And the weird thing is I got diagnosed on April 25th of this year with anemia, with blood loss induced anemia, but the doctor doesn't know the cause, and yet I wound up in the emergency room on August 23rd of last month. And the emergency room doctor came in and not only says your glucose is normal, but you're not anemic at this time. But yet I was so badly fatigued that day, I couldn't even like get up and get out of my storage unit, and I was getting really scared. And I called John, and he came and took me to the hospital. So, and I'm supposed to I went for this this appointment, you know, to go through the procedures for a colonoscopy, and I have the stuff that I need to do it, but I have to put that off. I can't do the colonoscopy because I have nowhere to recover. I can't. They wouldn't even give me a motel voucher for 3 nights so that I could go and get this colonoscopy done and then, like, have a motel bed to just lay in and rest in for a few days, you know, to recover. So, yeah, it's been kind of not such a nice road, to say the least.
Any reports from the homeless lack of service center clientele? I know you said you apparently you've had less connection with the people you were previously friendly with, Steve Laszlo and Mia, that are also now clients of disability activist John Colby. Any reports on anything that's been going on?
Mia seems to be doing okay. I bumped into her actually yesterday morning, and she seems to be doing okay. She's in the loft at this time. She's not sure what she's going to do, you know, when the loft closes down, which, let's see, yesterday, okay, so the 15th is on Saturday, next Saturday. She said, you know, she does have friends. She said she has a friend that lives around Foster Freeze that she could go and stay on their couch, but she doesn't want to impose. Now, Steve, on the other hand, apparently is back in the hospital. I don't know how long he's been back in the hospital, but I talked to John last night, and John said he's back in the hospital. They want to put him in a nursing home in Sacramento, but, of course, he doesn't want to go to a nursing home in Sacramento. He wants to be down here. You know, so, you know.
Now, today,
I haven't personally talked to Steve myself.
I understand. Thank you. I know today is the day of the meal that kind of where you had these incidents of exclusion, which ultimately resulted in your being, banned from the entire homeless lack of services center and even from the River Street shelter. Have you been able to go back to the meal, use the homeless lack of services center during the day, get your mail, maybe take a shower, things like that?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that question because my friend Linda, who's in a wheelchair, we were over on that side of town, and she wanted to go and have dinner there on Thursday because she hadn't eaten all day, and she was upset because she's been going through some other personal stuff. So I just said, okay, I'll go with you. And so we went in there and ate, and, of course, Mike Kittredge, who also works in the office there, that front office, came up to me and said, oh, we're working on finding the documentation you requested. It has to do with an incident that took place on February 1st earlier this year at the Armory. And he says, you know, just as soon as we get it, you know, we'll get it to you, blah, blah, blah. So that seemed to go okay. And then I finally, for the first time, went to breakfast this morning, and that same church volunteer still works at the door on Sunday mornings. And, and you know, he said good morning to me, and I just didn't say anything. I just walked past him and walked in the cafeteria and got my breakfast, sat down and ate it, and then left, you know.
I mean, that sounds like that's good. On the other hand, I want to say it takes a lot of ovaries there, Andrea, to be able to face that situation with the possibility that you're going to get the same kind of hassle again.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I thought about that, but then I thought, you know what? I don't think he'd actually be stupid enough to do that again because they're already in hot water. Because it's really funny. I wind up at the metro station and I run into my friend Ron, who John's also advocating for, and I brought up the incident to Ron. And, you know, like I said, the man is 64 years old, but he goes, oh, yeah, he goes, I remember, Andrea. I was in the cafeteria that morning. I saw him grab you, and I said, what? He goes, yeah. And I go, okay, Ron, I said, you know, what did you see? He goes, I said, just tell me what you saw. And he goes, well, I seen you, go walk in the dining room, and I seen him come up and grab you. And he, you know, was just showing me. He didn't grab my arm, but, you know, he grabbed the side of my arm, grabbed my shirt. And so I got to get a witness statement from him, like, this afternoon or tomorrow. He hangs out around the metro a lot.
So you were saying, yeah.
And I said, it's really important that you remember what you saw, you know. I said, well, sometimes...
So, Andrea, let me interrupt you here for a moment.
Sit down and,
let me interrupt you here.
You know,
Andrea,
sure.
Let me interrupt you for a moment because,
sure.
And I think we've talked about this a little. We've talked about it in past shows, but this has to do with a Sunday attempt to go to the meal, which apparently you're allowed to do today, where it's kind of a religious event. You thought that because perhaps you declined to do a prayer at one point, the next time you got hassled and you got bumped out of the line, and then you got forcibly removed and then banned by this guy, and now apparently. You know, you're allowed back in. Did they advise you that you were actually being allowed back in at any point, or did you have to kind of go back there and risk, again, further exclusion to see that you could get in?
Well, what I did was I decided to go back. I went there on Sunday morning, August 19th. And I walked up and I just parked my walker right there by the front door and sat down on it. And this jerk, William, comes walking over to me and says, "Oh, excuse me, ma'am, but they won't be serving you this morning." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he kept telling me, "You need to leave the campus." And I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Well, then you need to give that to me in writing." I kept trying to request for them to give it to me in writing, and of course they wouldn't. Then he threatened to call the cops. I said, "Go ahead, call the police." And said, "In fact, you know what? Why don't I call them for you?" You know?
I remember, We talked about this. So my question to you is, did you hear anything subsequent to that before you came today that said, "We've reconsidered and we're going to let you in"?
No, I just had a brief conversation with Mike Kittredge a couple weeks ago, and
Is he connected with the Sunday thing, or is he?
Mike Kittredge. Okay, him and Chris work in the front office, and Shelley, I believe, took Letitia's place. So her office is in the Paige Smith house there, but. He's part of the staff that, like, run the loft, and at one point he said he would acknowledge John and that they would recognize John as our advocate, but then he turns around, and after the incident, by the way, John had sent an email requesting an appeal, which was not only totally ignored, but Mike basically emailed.
Let me interrupt. Too much information, important stuff and interesting to me, but probably a little hard to follow for folks who are listening. So
yeah,
I'm trying to focus on the fact that you apparently had a conversation with this homeless lack of services center guy who has some kind of jurisdiction over the Sunday meal in some way. Did that advise you that it was okay for you to come back, or did you actually just have to kind of go in there blind and just be there and see what happened? I mean, after you were told by this guy at the door, "You can't come in here because of the fact that, you know, you're complaining about being treated badly by our thugs," which is how I interpret what happened. Did you get any further information that said you can come back to the Sunday meal from any of the people?
Well, no, not really. Yeah, you're kind of right. I mean, it took me having to call and... You know, anyway, just real short, Mike had sent an email back to John saying, "Well, now all of a sudden, I'm not going to, answer any more emails or any phone calls or anything." Just shunned him up. And so what happened was I called Mike, and, you know, and the whole ban thing was so confusing. As far as I knew, I wasn't allowed anywhere on premises. But then Mike turns around and says, "Oh, no, you can come and you can use, you know, our day services, you know, if you need to come and take a shower or whatever." But it's all so confusing, Robert. I mean, those people are so inconsistent. They're all over the map.
At the present time, they allow you to, then, as far as you know, you've been able to take showers and do other stuff there without being hindered.
Apparently, that's what the word was.
That's
but
the
I
word.
I had to call to get that information.
When was the last time you actually, other than this morning, when was the last time you used their services?
Oh, gosh, it's been over a month.
And the reason you haven't is because, in spite of this reassurance by Mike Kittredge, you feel apprehensive about going back there, or disinclined, or...
Well, the thing is that the way they put it to me was that you're banned from the campus for 30 days, meaning you're not allowed on the premises. In fact, that's why I tried to see what would happen when I went there on the morning of August 19th on Sunday, and when William came out and said, "Oh, they won't be serving you today. You need to leave the campus."
Right, but
so kind of at that point, I got the impression, "Oh, okay, I'm not even allowed on the campus."
And now, so
then I did eventually leave.
So even though you declined to leave at that point, you said, "Call the police, I'll call the police for you," you decided not to try to use any other services between then and this morning on Sunday. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Have you heard of this happening to anybody else in the last month?
Well, no, not too much. Oh, by the way, yeah, actually, it kind of did. My other friend who's disabled, who's dying of cancer, Stan Willis, him and I are basically the two. They've really been dogging on and retaliating against the worst. And they wouldn't let Stan in the loft, and they wouldn't even... And when he tried to call one night to get a crisis a couple weeks ago, they basically told him that they didn't want him at the River Street shelter. So I saw Stan, I don't know, sometime within the last week, and Stan said he got pissed off. He goes, you know what, Andrew? He goes, I went to the mayor's office. He said he went down to the mayor's office. I guess he talked to the mayor, and I guess Don Lane did something, and next thing you know, Stan's in the loft. I said, well, good for you.
Well, that sounds good. I know that Lane has refused to, so far, come on the show with me, either my show or the community TV show that he was on before. And he says he's negotiating with Sandy Lee, the show person but will not come on with me, which is, you know, okay. We'll get somebody else will want to, you know, discuss these issues with him. The problem, you know, is always that I think I'm not unique. Obviously, there are other people who I think share these concerns. It's just I have spent the time and energy really focusing on them and articulating them and having a dialogue with him and seeing, you know, how he ducks and dodges and weaves and doesn't want to address the issues. I mean, he does take special actions in the individual cases, which I think is good, but the general policies don't seem to have been made clear. I don't see a list of the rules about the due process that people have if they're excluded. As you say, when you try to get something in writing, you don't seem to be able to get it. So there's some real problems that are not being addressed, and admittedly, we're talking about services that are very limited and for a very relatively small proportion of the homeless population, but that are getting all this focus as a kind of a wonderful panacea. It's really kind of, sure, more services are great. The services exist. It's good that there are some services. But the fact is you have to look at what's really going on every night. You have one activist sleeping by the side of the road. You, because of what's going on. So, yeah, I appreciate your calling in, Andrea. We have about 3 minutes left. Anything you want to finish with?
Well, like I said before, real quickly, it's all about favoritism over there. And, you know, if you're willing to become, you know, a little work slave and perhaps do something like the River Street's house laundry for them every week, you know, you can save for, you know, many months. But, you know, if you're outspoken like me and, you know, you stand up to corruption and whatnot, and they don't like you, well, unfortunately, they will boot your ass out into the street and, you know, and they will do everything in their power to keep you out. Like I said, no due process, nothing in writing, no warnings of any kind, just, okay, that's it, you're banned, you're out of here. And they don't care if you have health problems and you use a walker, you know, they'll just throw you out in the street, and that's just what they do.
Andrea, would you be willing to go on TV and debate Don Lane?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I will propose that to Sandra Lee.
Some of the emails that he sent, in fact, you know, I need to have a little chat with him because some of the emails that he sent back in response to John Colby really pissed me off. And I need to get those copies of those emails from John. I'll probably try to get them this week.
I'll suggest that to Sandy, and maybe she can get in touch with you. I'll give her your number. And maybe, because Lane, you know, he may not be willing to go on with you either. You know, he may claim he's protecting your confidentiality.
Oh, right.
That was one of his excuses, I remember.
I know that. Yeah, I know about that, too. I know.
Well, in the meantime, you know, I appreciate you're doing what you're doing. I'll be at the Occupy Santa Cruz at 2 if you happen to wander by. I can give you some of my trail mix. We can chow down together with that. And, you know. Post office, main steps of the post office in about an hour where I'll be. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for offering to, should we say, provide a counterpoint to Don Lane's claims. You can point out the problems, and maybe he can solve them on the air. You never can tell. You know?
Okay, will do.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, sweetheart. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Andrea. And, that was Andrea Morgan. And we kind of talked about that. I think we're at almost the end of our rope. Let's see, at the end of our show, and I'm at the end of my rope, but let's see if we've got anything more here. Finish up this tape, and I'll be on my way.
And, Matt, what happened? What kind of crimes were you engaged in?
Well, being houseless, I was camping in the forest one winter, and the rangers came along, found me, and told me I couldn't live in the forest.
And when did that happen?
November.
November last year.
So you've been ousted from the forest, and then what is your situation now?
Housed, but after much effort.
Hello.
Well, that's good.
So it's past 9. We got to get back over to the city hall because they'll kick us out there after 10. So
occupy city hall.
Hopefully, we're ready now to go back to city hall for a little bit of rally, some more food, some music. All right, tense up.
And there's an example of difference of opinion between two activists. Although I was not seriously about to occupy City Hall, the idea that the whole protest should be sort of constrained by the police parameters, to me, is defeats the purpose of the protest to begin with. Because what you have is a real protest, its real power is in the authorities don't know what's going to happen next, really. That they have to take account of the fact that they are dealing with angry people who have a legitimate protest, who are presenting legitimate demands, which they are illegitimately ignoring. And if they continue to do that, it's likely to ramp up the situation one way or another. It's not means that they're going to house is going to be burned down or anybody's going to be killed, but it means that the pressure is going to intensify. And one way to intensify pressure on the city authorities, not often very effectively, but to some extent it's demonstrative to the community, is to camp out. And it also provides a sanctuary of a kind for homeless people who are may understand that they may be ticketed, but at least they'll be ticketed in the eye of video and audio and people who are witnesses and seeing what's happening. And people can testify there is no shelter for them to go to. People who can testify that their property is either being taken or not being taken, what's going on. So it has a certain advantage. But if people are tiptoeing around because they're afraid the police are going to give them a ticket, the protest is sort of stuck, has been my feeling. Now, that said, Brent Adams, myself, Becky Johnson, three main activists who are a part of that protest, do face, we're the Santa Cruz 11, so we have been, in essence, put in a special sort of torture chamber where if we do protest and we do get arrested for disobeying a law, we can immediately, arguably, be taken to jail for violating what's called our OR condition, the condition of our own release on these phony charges. I mean, we shouldn't be under any charges at all, but they are cooked up these charges, which seem to be not just an attempt to deflect, you know, do some electioneering around election eve and say, see, we won't let these Occupy Santa Cruz people take over a building, which we didn't do. We were present, as were hundreds of others, but we didn't take over the building nor vandalize it. So it is a way of essentially intimidating us from future protest and denying people possibly a more aggressive leadership, because we risk more when we do that. And I have to say, Brent put together this protest to some extent under that Damocles sword. So it's a mixed bag. I'm going to, I think, leave it at that for this particular show. I want to take one more look at the email to see if anything has come in. There are some events coming up at Occupy Monterey, I see. Taking a look at these. They have their general assemblies on Saturday at 10:30 at Colton Hall on Pacific Avenue. You can probably find all this information online. They have a radical community gathering every Sunday from 4 to 6 at the East Village Coffee Shop in Monterey. I've never been there. I'd like to probably should check that out. Then there is a sustainable living tour from 11 to 4 today, or there was, with presentations on composting, beekeeping, drought, tolerant planning, goat keeping, and so forth, and a raffle. On Tuesday, there's a Board of Supervisors meeting on the presentation of a foreclosure petition and a request the county investigate the option of using eminent domain to prevent further illegal foreclosures. I don't know that that's been done in Santa Cruz. It's a prospect, and it may have been done. My attempts to get Occupy Santa Cruz's group active around this, or at least communicating with me what they're doing, have been unsuccessful, but that doesn't mean they aren't doing something. Progressive election opportunities comes up on the 12th over there. 5 R's for the road to resilience: refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle, and rot. Zero waste. Two guys are going to be speaking in Pacific Grove at the Natural History Museum over there on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, Peter Lunsdane, I remember him from the Resource Center for Nonviolence, he's an educational outreach coordinator for AROS, Alliance to Resist Robotic Warfare in Society. He's going to be discussing robotic weapons and war zones, publicizing a statewide conference October 18th through 21st. He's known for unauthorized investigations into advanced weapons and surveillance programs within the security zones of the U.S. Strategic Command facilities. Has worked with nonprofit organizations for 20 years as researcher, organizer, photographer, lecturer, and writer on peace and international security. Been to armed conflict zones in Guatemala, Philippines, Mexico, and occupied Iraq's Shiite heartland, along with Korea, Japan, Jordan, and many areas across the United States. And he's organizing this conference to be held in Santa Barbara, and he's speaking, I guess, 6:30 on Thursday. And you can find out all this stuff. There's, of course, all kinds of other massive stuff happening. I probably should be talking about Occupy Santa Cruz, but there's not usually too much on that website. Let's see if anything actually is happening on their Occupy Santa Cruz website. All those events I just listened, if you go to the Occupy Monterey website, you should be able to find them, I think. Though I got an email, I'm not entirely clear. Yeah, the only thing on the Santa Cruz website is a September 17th caravan to San Francisco for a kind of a yearly protest. There is a statement affirming, "We affirm the right of our sister occupations to fight economic injustice using methods of peaceful protest. We make the declaration of solidarity and affirm that should police attempt to forcibly disrupt any occupation within a 100-mile radius, we agree to a rally at a mass protest organized by the hosting occupation. We urge all occupations to sign this declaration as a show of solidarity to your area occupation. An assault to one of us is an assault to all of us. Power to the peaceful," and right on to the Occupy for doing that. And there's a BN kickoff Friday the 14th, this coming Friday. And there's a human BN the 15th and the 16th in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And on Monday the 17th, there's a one-year anniversary. And there's, you can read more on the website about these different events that, again, are all out of town. And then there's the Candlelight Vigil with this great flyer that Brent put out for the Friday March. I think that's it. Let's see if there's any minor residue of the protest here.
And the Brent will lead us forward. We have an ancient artist who seems to have joined the gang. Tim, are you a part of this parade?
Yeah. A two candle holding vigiler.
You are a vigiler, vigiling away. This reminds me of your behavior, I think it was, what, 16 years ago in 1996? City Hall, posters.
Yeah.
Three
camping tickets.
Where was your criminal behavior on the, actually a block from here?
And actually, Tim Rinker is an artist who designed the flyer for the 8-month-long City Hall sleepers protest that happened throughout 1996. From the time the armory let out, activists Dragon Czar Dan Hopkins and I called him shit kicker Sean Alimi, who was a leading food provider for a group called Feed the People, led a protest at City Hall that tried to stay awake during the day, during the night, and sleep during the day, as to abide by the city's crazy rules, which aren't really rules, they're just ways of giving the police the power to arrest and drive away folks. And Tim Rinker was an activist who designed a lot of posters, and then about 6 years later he was arrested for chalking political slogans on the sidewalk along with Becky Johnson. They were both convicted of this crime, even though it was erasable chalk, even though they agreed to wash it away, even though nobody else had been arrested for that. Becky was actually taken to jail for that. I guess it was her first jailing. Her second was this Santa Cruz 11 frame-up thing that's happening and that continues to go on. So, continuing and hopefully concluding.
chalking on the sidewalk. Actually, it was right at this corner, I believe.
Yeah.
Right down the street here, you were caught chalk-handed, so to speak.
Hopscotch is not a crime.
According to Becky Johnson, yes. Good to see you again. Anything new you want to tell us about what's been happening with you?
I'm living right next to that new Warriors to be supposedly, maybe, hopefully not, stadium.
Aren't you a sports fan, my friend?
Yeah, but not drunken. I don't like drunken sports fans.
I see. Well, your kind will be disposed of soon enough.
My candle's lighting a fire in the cup here.
Your candle seems to be burning bright before its demise. Perhaps similar to the protest, but we'll see.
Maybe I should leave it.
So, Steve, we're back here at the City Hall, and Brent has once more stepped up to the mic.
Give it up for Stephen Prince!
Yeah! It is a treasure.
Got it? Yeah. You know, I was talking to Patrick Dwyer as we were walking along here, and a couple of things came to mind. We all came here tonight, each of us individually, out of sadness and anger and frustration about the victimization of the homeless community. We're all coming together collectively to form a coalition to end that victimization, to end that demonization, and to end criminalization of the homeless people. You know that coalitions are an old style of activism, and oftentimes they rise up around issues or people, and they're good for awareness and energy, but that's the old style coalition. Tonight, we're here to establish a new style of coalition. That's the coalition of the mind, coalition of the heart, and coalition of the spirit around homeless people. Because homeless people and homeless communities...
And that is where we ran out of tape, or I did anyway. Thanks for listening. This has been Bathrop Spears Broadsides, a twice-weekly show. Come back next on Thursday at 6 in the evening. I'll be at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 10 o'clock on Wednesday morning with a Huff meeting, and I'll be wandering over to the Occupy Santa Cruz get-together at 2 o'clock today at the post office steps. If you want to get involved, there is a city council meeting on Tuesday. There's a discussion starting at 3, which will involve the $250,000 for private security thugs to hassle homeless people, though they're not quite putting it that way, I'm sure. That's on the consent agenda starting at 3 at City Hall on Tuesday. Then there's at 5 o'clock, there's anal communications, where they give you a little chance to chat for 3 minutes or two if there are more than 10 speakers. Don Lane never extends the time. He always contracts the amount of time we have to speak, unlike the Board of Supervisors, which allows people 3 minutes each, regardless of how many people there are. Santa Cruz City Council apparently doesn't think that's... Santa Cruz population is less worthy of being listened to than the county population. And then at 7 o'clock, if you're interested in dealing with the... watching the... or speaking about the issue of the Dakota Wizards, to be known as the Santa Cruz Warriors, the $4.1 million boondoggle proposal that the city council is pushing, I think you might want to show up there. Call me on the Huff line if you want to talk to me about anything you've heard on the show. If you want to volunteer anytime, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll talk to you.